Global BC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, Australian police have alleged the two men accused of carrying out the Bondi Beach shooting had weapons training days before the attack. Court documents also claim the pair recorded a video setting out what they called their justification for their actions. One gunman was shot dead by police. Another man is facing 15 murder charges. Premier of New South Wales, Chris Mims, says reforms to gun laws are being considered with urgency.
This legislative change will be met with opposition both on the floor of Parliament and in the community. I've heard members of the public say that we've gone too far, but I strongly believe these changes to law and legislation in New South Wales are fundamentally important to keep this state safe.
The Health Secretary Wes Streeting has been criticised after appearing to hint the UK should join a customs union with the EU. It's a suggestion which the Prime Minister recently ruled out. Political rivals have accused Mr Streeting of making a bid for the Labour leadership instead of focusing on the NHS. Speaking to Lewis Goodall on LBC yesterday, the Labour chair Anna Turley said there are no tensions within Cabinet.
Wes is a very talented guy and he's doing great stuff in the NHS.
Should he wind his neck in a little bit?
Well, look, the Prime Minister is a confident Prime Minister who knows that he's got lots of talent in the Cabinet around him. And I don't think he has a problem at all with people coming out and setting out their
vision. Is that why his team briefed against him?
Well, the Prime Minister wasn't aware of that. And, I know that when he looks around the Cabinet table, he sees the team that he's chosen who are working with him. And he's, working with them on their agenda.
Wes Streeting has previously denied on LBC leading a plot to oust Sir Keir Starmer. A Russian general has been killed in an explosion in Moscow. Officials say it was a car bomb. Vinil Sararov was the head of operational training for the armed forces. Russian officials say they suspect Ukraine was behind it, but Kyiv hasn't commented. Resident doctors in England have returned to work this morning following their five-day strike over pay and jobs, but the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has warned that NHS services will take time to catch up. Ministers are reportedly considering following Australia in banning social media for under-16s. A government spokesman has told LBC that nothing's off the table, but any action will be based on robust evidence. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 47 at 98.50. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 14. LBC weather dry and bright for most today. Some outbreaks of rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland. A high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission. And it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Well, a very good morning to you. It's Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien up to Christmas Eve this week here on LBC. The date is the 22nd of December, and although that means we are perilously close to the big day, there is still, curiously enough, thankfully enough, gracefully enough, perhaps, a lot of politics going on that we can discuss throughout the course of the next 3 hours. And there is an intriguing, almost crack, it feels to me right now, in the edifice that has been the Brexit settlement, the thing that Boris Johnson left with us back in 2019. For 6 years now, since the general election, almost 6 years to the day, in fact. You remember the 19th of December 2019, that historic landslide win for Boris Johnson, which delivered him a majority of 80. Get Brexit done, he said, and as a result of that general election, he did get it done. Brexit, though, since then, in a political sense, has been put into something of cold storage. The Brexit wars, which characterised those years, I was covering it as a Sky News political correspondent at the time, internecine, day after day, parliamentary attrition, bit by bit, vote by vote, lobby by lobby, a nightmare for MPs, a political system which seemed that it could not digest the insolubility of Brexit itself. And the general election did clear that blockage. And as a result of that, Labour wanted it left alone. The Tories wanted it left alone. Even the Lib Dems wanted it left alone. And you'll remember they went into the 29 general election arguing for not just a cessation, not just a pause on Brexit, but the complete revocation of Article 50. God, even talking in this language, it feels sort of conjures all that sort of time, or at least for me. Since then, it has been a slow, quiet truce. The intriguing thing for us this morning, and indeed for the politics to think about 2026, is whether that quiet truce, that uneasy stasis, is about to snap through the prism of an incoming, potentially incoming, Labour leadership election, no less. Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, who mysteriously enough, you may have noticed, has been out and about a little bit more than usual over the course of the last couple of weeks, got a lot to say for himself, did a almost Bowdoin catalogue-like interview, walking through the woods with The Observer over the course of the weekend. An interview with The Observer, he has said, among other things, "I'm really uncomfortable with the level of taxation in this country. The best way for us to get more growth into our economy is a deeper trading relationship with the EU. Now, that is being widely interpreted as a call for a new customs union with the EU, or at least a trading relationship which gets close to it. Because in the same interview, he also says that he would not accept a return to freedom of movement. You'll remember that means ruling out membership of the single market, because that inherently involves membership or being party to European freedom of movement. So if we want a closer relationship that is something short of single market, full regulatory alignment with the rules being set by Brussels, with the full sort of strictures of freedom of movement which come along with it, then basically it leads you inevitably to a shared customs union, where it means we would not be able to do our own independent trade deals, or would have to do it in conjunction at least with the EU. This is something you will know that Keir Starmer has ruled out. It's something that Wes Streeting effectively ruled out when he stood on the Labour manifesto. So why is he saying it? He is saying it because he knows that it is highly, highly popular, not only with Labour voters in the country, but also, crucially, with Labour members. And it is, of course, Labour members that, if and when there is a leadership contest, will be voting for the next Prime Minister. And clearly, Wes Streeting, who has maybe some problems with some elements of the Labour membership, clearly working out the politics and moving there directly. Poll for the Times over the course of the last few days showing that a customs union has support of 80% of Labour members, never mind even Labour voters. It's even popular with 37% of Tory voters. So you can feel maybe the shifting sands of this politics. You heard Anna Turley, the chair of the Labour Party, in the news there talking to me on my Sunday show, saying that this is not going to be an issue given the Prime Minister has ruled it out. Tell that to Wes Streeting. It's also the issue of Brexit, because let's be honest, we know at this point now, we've got enough data. In the early years when we left, because we left on the 30th of January 2020, we didn't have the full leaving process till 2021, that inevitably co-joined with COVID and the inevitable economic damage. It was very hard to disaggregate between Brexit and COVID. But now COVID has passed, certainly economically speaking, although we're still living with the legacy in lots of ways. But nonetheless, we can see the damage of Brexit that is being incurred day after day, week after week. That is something that I put to the Shadow Policing Minister and Conservative MP for Stockton West, Matt Vickers, speaking to me yesterday on RBC. Would you accept that you damage free markets and growth in this country more than any government since the war?
No.
Well, in which case, what would you make of the fact that a very authoritative new paper with excellent pedigree, published by the America's National Bureau of Economic Research, very respected, written by economists from Stanford University, the Bank of England, King's College London, and the German Central Bank, and the University of Nottingham, say that the signature achievement of your last government, Brexit, has cost every single man, woman, and child in this country £3,000 in terms of lost economic growth?
I'm sure that those people probably would have told you that was what was going to happen. Well, I mean, we heard the sky was going to fall.
They're all just woke. America's National Bureau of Economic Research. What skin in the game have they got?
This new publication I've never heard of. I'll tell you what the difference is.
Well, have you heard of
Before the general election, we had the fastest growing economy in the G7. We've now got the slowest growth in the G7. We had near record levels of employment. 21%
You're saying that Brexit's been good for this country economically?
I think it's created opportunities. We've gone out there, we've set up trade agreements.
You're there having a go at Rachel Reeves for increased bureaucracy, of friction for business, of making life difficult for business. Have you ever tried a small business exporting to Europe these days? It's a nightmare.
Let me take you out of Westminster. You can come up north, speak to some people who are creating jobs.
I'm talking about exporters, small businesses, people trying to send goods to Europe. It is so much harder than it used to be because of your government. You made life harder for business in this country.
However bad you might think it was going, I'm sure you thought it was terrible, you always did. But the reality is that 21% more people are out of work. Inflation is up. Borrowing is up. Taxes are up.
So that was Matt Vickers, a Conservative shadow minister, talking to me on my Sunday show yesterday. A few other stats just to throw into the mix before we speak to Naomi Smith from the CEO of Best for Britain. UK GDP estimated, as I say, to be 6 to 8% smaller in 2025 than it would have been if the UK had remained in the EU. The OBR has projected Brexit will reduce long-term national income by about 4% relative to staying in the EU. Business investment is estimated to be 12 to 18% lower than it would have been without Brexit. Employment maybe 3 to 4% lower due to prolonged uncertainty and trade frictions. Productivity, and we're already lamentable on productivity, also estimated to be 3 to 4% lower. And no one can say, of course, that being part of the EU is an economic salve. It's not. Many EU countries right now, in Western Europe at least, are struggling. But it is undoubtedly true that with an open trading economy like ours, Brexit was always going to be highly damaging. It was never going to be the sky falling in, all that cliches that we heard there from Matt Vickers. It was going to be more like a slow puncture in a tire. And that is what we're seeing. So what I want to speak to you about this morning is, when will be, and maybe are we, in 2026, moving into 2026, are there the first signs that we are in a level-headed way, 10 years on, of course, as it will be from the referendum itself in 2026? 10 years, where have they gone? Actually, I can feel them. It's like dog years. That you can feel maybe there is the possibility that we are starting to reckon with, have a more grown-up conversation about the economic costs of Brexit. Are we ready to finally accept that it has been economically damaging? And if so, are we ready to have a more grown-up conversation about what comes next? And indeed, do you think that Keir Starmer, given he is languishing in the polls, if he thinks it would be good for Britain to rejoin elements of the EU, not the EU in its entirety, but elements of it, then what's he got to lose at this point? Should he do it? And could that win your support back? 0345 60 60 973, 0345 60 60 973. The usual numbers, don't change it, because just James is away, of course. Naomi Smith is the CEO of Best for Britain. Naomi, do you think the politics of this appears to be shifting?
Well, the mood in the country certainly shifts. At Best for Britain, we commissioned YouGov to do a poll asking people, do you think Brexit has been a failure or a success? And 62% to 11 say failure. And that really rockets up when you ask people who did vote Labour last year and people who are still intending to vote Labour. That goes north of 85%. Reform voters split three ways, about a third saying failure, a third saying don't know, and a third saying that it has been indeed a success. So and that's one the mood of the country caught up.
Sorry to interrupt that, Naomi. I was going to say, just to sort of hammer that home, and one of the interesting things about the polling on Brexit, and as I say, it's something I think we will be talking more of next year, because it's 10 years on, and inevitably we'll be feeling, sort of starting to sort of really assess, have a good sort of run in to be able to assess what's happened. It's true to say that actually, whether you were a Remainer or a Leaver, and of course there's a huge part of the electorate now as well, who never got a chance to vote in that referendum, you know, they'll be well into their late 20s by now, who, if you're a Leaver or Remainer, actually you're dissatisfied with the Brexit settlement, potentially for different reasons, but you're dissatisfied with it.
Indeed. And we did ask them why. If people said they thought it was a failure, we asked them why. And the vast majority of respondents saying because of the economic damage it has done to the country and how much harder it's made it to trade with the EU. So that very point that Matt Vickers was challenging you on, Lewis, in that clip you played earlier, is where the country are. They are saying this hasn't worked. We haven't got more control over our lives. We can't afford what we used to be able to afford. Everything's got more expensive. And we now realise that, separate from the impact of Ukraine and the lockdown period of COVID, that Brexit is putting a premium on what we're paying for at the tills and at the pumps and in our energy bills. So I think what we're seeing now is the politics catching up with the economic reality that voters have been feeling now for many years.
What about the argument, which has got some truth to it, Naomi, but what about the argument to say that, look, if you're a Brexiter, you'd say that they feel vindicated right now. They feel vindicated because we've got an administration in the United States which dislikes, abhors the EU, sees it as actively deleterious to American security interests. And as a result of not being in the EU, we were able to negotiate a lower tariff, certainly initially at least, than the EU were imposed upon them by the US.
Well, indeed, the word being initially, and actually where Europe has managed to get to with the US is not in too much of a dissimilar position. While our tariff rate might be lower on vehicles, it's capped at 100,000, whereas the EU's is completely limitless in terms of that. So when you look at the minutiae of the detail, the UK hasn't actually had a better deal from Donald Trump than the EU has done. And I think where voters are is that for those who were concerned about the sovereignty aspect of being within the EU and, oh, look, they try and control us over bendy bananas, what they've now seen is that actually we find ourselves in a situation where we have got Donald Trump trying to control Britain and bring Europe ever closer into the sphere of influence of the USA in the emergence of what Trump calls these three major blocks of China, Russia and the United States. And then, of course, on our eastern flank, we have a war in Europe. We have Putin and the threat of that. And I think that ordinary British people are now beginning to see, rather than being cast adrift, bobbing around mid-Atlantic, we really do need to deepen and strengthen our ties with the European Union.
The difficulty, of course, Naomi, though, isn't it, is kind of as much as anyone might wish and would like to see those ties to be intensified, given the sort of political strictures and restrictions which do exist, the Prime Minister has been clear about the sort of red lines of it, that it is not very practical to see what much more they could do beyond that. And even if the PM, or a new PM, say Wes Streeting, came in and said, yeah, okay, well, we will rejoin or join a customs union, negotiating a customs union, because it probably would be a new customs union, not the old customs union, a new customs union alone. The EU are tough negotiators, and it would not be easy. They would want some significant concessions in exchange for it.
Of course, and the EU are listening to this internal Labour Party discussion, which of course is what the leadership candidates are doing at the moment. Their pronouncements to the media, the interviews that they're doing, are really for Labour members because of any impending leadership election happening. But of course, Europe are listening too. And I think it is worth just taking stock for a moment. And what do we really mean by customs union in terms of how it would benefit the UK? You mentioned to Matt Vickers about all of that tariff, trade barrier inhibition that businesses have got now in trying to export into the EU. Well, a customs union probably only removes about 2-8% of a product's costs because it gets rid of that need to comply with the rules of origin regulation that the EU have. But none of the other tariff barriers come away from that. You don't get any of the exemptions from having to do excise forms, VAT forms, health and safety checks. What actually delivers that is beneficial alignment, which is actually what Starmer's government is beginning to negotiate now with the EU. And I think the kind of point of crisis that could come is that EU summit that the UK and EU had last May, it's going to be an annual one, it's going to happen again in May 2026 or possibly later in the year, could now butt up against any potential leadership challenge within Labour. And that, of course, will put everything on ice rather than expedite, as our businesses so sorely need, that closer trading relationship, removing some of those barriers, particularly for the agri-food sector and energy sector, and then hopefully in future onto other sectors of industry, because that's where we'll get the growth, not solely from a customs union. A final point on it, Turkey is in a customs union with the EU. That hasn't stopped the EU introducing a permanent 50% tariff on steel with Turkey. So I think anyone calling for a customs union needs to be challenged on exactly the numbers that they think it will do to benefit businesses and the UK economy at large.
Naomi Smith there, CEO of Best for Britain. I want to turn to you and ask you whether, as I say, we were going into 2026, we're 10 years on from the Brexit referendum in June 2016. There will be millions of the electorate who never had a chance to vote in that referendum. The politics, nonetheless, has basically been frozen since that day. Are we finally 10 years on, ready to have a different conversation, not just about Brexit, but about what we want our future relationship with Europe to look like? Because this was one of the problems with that whole conversation at that time. Europe, however much the most fervent Brexiters might like it otherwise, ain't going anywhere. Britain is a European country. For all of the nonsense talked about global Britain, the fact is our most intense trading relationships, quel surprise, to coin a phrase, are those who are with those who are closest to us, with France, with Germany, the Nordic countries, some of the powerhouses like Poland of Eastern Europe. And right now, we have the most distant economic relationship of any European country with those European countries anywhere on the continent of Europe. Turkey, as Naomi was saying there, has got a closer relationship. Ukraine has got a closer relationship. Britain is on its own. 10 years on, can we finally dare to dream that we might have a sensible, grown-up conversation about Brexit, what it's done, and what should come next. 0345-6060973, 0345-6060973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall, sitting in for James O'Brien this week on LBC. The time is 10:19.
LBC.
My beans have been to Mexico. They once went to Peru. My beans, they flew to Portugal, then went to Tuvalu. My beans were with me in Italy, then came with me to Greece. I slurped their sauce on Spanish shores. I nibbled them in Nice. My Heinz beans have seen the world. They've travelled far and wide because they are, as we all know, too good to leave behind.
Okay, let me stop you there, sir. You still have to check them into the hold.
Oh, all right then. Honestly.
Beans means Heinz.
Waitrose presents...
I really fancy a mince pie.
One man's selfless journey from sofa to kitchen.
I'm getting up.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, and zesty limoncello.
With some cream.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, zesty limoncello, and a dollop of fresh cream.
Limoncello.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Selected stores subject to availability.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345-6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Just on that conversation I had with Matt Vickers, the Conservative Shadow Minister, who was putting up a game defence of his position, his party's position. He's a Brexiton, fair enough. I would just say the irritation I have is simply as ever it was back in 2016 and 17 and 18 and 19 and 20. It's just like the sort of surreal abnormality, the kind of surreal kind of lack of reality of just having a practical conversation about the effects of this thing. Like, perfectly fair enough to be a Brexiter, perfectly fair enough to prioritise sovereignty, perfectly fair enough, by the way, to think the EU is a bit of an anti-democratic carbuncle. I sort of think all of those things as well. But it's just when you respond to questions by going, saying, get out of London, is absurd. I'm talking about businesses that are not in London. Just very quickly, as an example of what it means to be outside of the customs union, for example. Let's say you're a small UK food producer in Mr. Vickers' constituency in Stockton. Let's say that before Brexit, you sold £5,000 worth of, I don't know, cheese a month or something like that to delis in northern France. You'd need one invoice, one delivery note, cheese went on a van, Calais to Paris, no customs forms, no checks, profit margin, you know, decent. After Brexit, what do you have to do? You've got to do all this. You've got to have an export declaration or pay an agent 50 to 100 quid per shipment, commodity codes for each product, proof of origin paperwork to qualify for zero tariffs. Then because cheese is a product of animal origin, you'd have to have an export health certificate signed by a vet, 150 to 300 quid per shipment, pre-notification of the EU's tracing system, possible physical inspection at the EU border. And if there's any delay, which there are loads more of now, by the way, then obviously clearly some cheese or food products or whatever it happens to be can go off. It can make French buyers nervous about UK reliability. Many EU couriers now simply refuse as a result to take UK food loads. And on top of that, VAT rules are more complex. Payment delays increase. French buyers ask the UK seller to absorb extra costs. So on £5,000 of exports, the estimate costs can rise by between £700 to £1,000 a month. And what you're doing then, you're saying, au revoir, profit margin. Au revoir. Bye-bye. And so guess what? If you're a small UK food producer in Mr. Vickers' constituency, chances are you just don't bother. It's fine for the Tescos and the big boys and all the big supermarkets or the big farmers and whatever, but if you're a small to medium-sized producer in this country, you just don't bother. That is what we're living with day after day after day. Say you think it's worth it. Fair enough. Tell that producer, I'm afraid that's the cost of freedom. Don't quite understand that slightly jaundiced concept of freedom, but, you know, fine, that's your concept of freedom. But at least level with them and be honest about the effects and the truth and the reality. Let's turn to Troy, who is in Crawley, who has got, as a business owner himself, I think, Troy.
How you doing, Lewis?
I'm well, thank you. Yeah, good, good. You own a company which I think used to export to the EU, is that right?
I export to the EU. I have exported to you. I have a EU company and I have a Canadian company. Mm-hmm. So I'm well aware of this. Actually, when I heard you say it, I've heard it a few times, it's harder to ship to the EU and stuff like that. It's a commercial invoice. If someone before Brexit wanted to send something to Switzerland or Norway, you would have to do the same export invoice as before. HS codes have been around since day one. So there's no difference.
There is a difference, Troy, because you didn't need those things before.
You did. You couldn't ship something anywhere in Europe without actually explaining to what it was.
But Troy, I mean, it's just untrue. I mean, Troy, like, if you're, as I've just literally gone through the customs paperwork, if you're, say, a cheese exporter or a small goods exporter, I've just gone through all the extra things that you'd need that you didn't need before, including, as I say, export declarations, sanitary and phytosanitary requirements, and, of course, you've also got VAT rules, which are more complex, and the fact that there are extra delays at the border. So it's not true to say it's as easy to export to the EU as it was before.
So I'm only talking our goods. Our goods are durable goods. And it is absolutely, we have just as many delays if we have a Chinese import. I've had delays with HMRC in England for months.
Yes, because China's not part of the EU. I mean, the whole point is...
I'm talking about importing.
Yeah, but okay.
Delays are part of any type of export, import, export. It's just the luck of the draw. If your stuff gets, if you get your stuff... comes under scrutiny, but that can happen. It doesn't have to happen in Brexit. It happens in Canada. It happens in Europe. You get an inspection, you get an inspection.
But let me give you another example. Let me give you some other examples, Troy. I mean,
but I do it weekly. Every week I'm shipping to the EU with no problem. Well, I'm nowhere near those costs.
I'm pleased to hear that, but I think you'll find that, you know, there will be many others who don't share that experience, not least because... and obviously these things will get easier over time and doubtless have got a little bit easier than the immediate post-Brexit period. But, you know, for example, here's just another small example. If something is innocuous sort of in my line of work, if you're going to do some filming in the EU or you're going to require to take some sound equipment or whatever it happens to be, I used to be able to do that, go to the border, no checks required, no carnets required. Now, every time I go, I have to, or I'm with a cameraman, with a producer, whatever, sit in some customs arrangement or border arrangement for hours, filling endless numbers of carnet forms with a cost of £400 per carnet per item, which, again, completely disincentivizes any desire to go and work in the EU. And then on top of that, if you're, say, a touring company or you're part of an orchestra, each of every individual item that you're going over there, again, requires carnets and declaration forms and paperwork and vice versa. So you know what happens? Many EU touring companies, whether it's in music or wherever it happens to be, don't bother coming to the UK and vice versa.
So what I would say to that is that, don't forget, I'm a Canadian. So I've had to do this since I landed here to do that if I go to Europe. If you go to Europe on a trade show or something like that, there is no problem. If you want to bring the goods back, okay, you have to fill in some paperwork because you don't pay the taxes when you go in to bring the stuff back out. Okay, this is all the same thing if you did this in Switzerland or Norway.
Yeah, but they weren't, Detroit, but Switzerland and Norway weren't part of the EU. I mean, you're comparing apples and oranges. The whole point is that we used to be part of a single market of 450 million people where none of this were required. And it's totally fair enough for you to say, well, look, it's just some paperwork, it's bureaucracy, maybe it's worth it for other reasons. But what you can't do is deny that the paperwork and the bureaucracy exists and we didn't have it before, and it's inconvenient and it's costly and it adds economic inefficiency.
So I accept that there might be some cost to it, but it's not a huge cost. And it's the same cost you would do as if you exported to Dubai. So when you look at the advantages of being able to export and have your own deals everywhere and to have your own rules and laws, on balance, it's much better. You only look at the economic. It might cost maybe 1%, but think if when it was free trade, how many people were coming into the country unabanished? Like, you know, there's a cost to that, and you've got to look at the total cost. As you know, UK, I think, is much better off. They just have to go take advantage of the fact that they can do different deals with different people.
But Troy, I mean, you're sort of making my point for me. When we were part of the EU, we had the most liberalized, intensive trading relationship that we could have, right? You're saying, oh, actually, what is better, and this was always a fallacy of the economics of Brexit, which is it would be better to have lots of smaller trade deals with countries that are either much smaller, well, way smaller in terms of their economy than in the EU, to get some modest trade liberalisation. How could that possibly be better than having the most liberalised trade deal with the biggest economy in the world, or one of the biggest economies in the world, right on our doorstep?
I know, but here what it boils down to. Just because you have a trade deal, you have to have good products. You know, people will still buy English products. People buy our products because they're better.
Troy, just engage what I'm saying. And then this is happening right now, right? This is very well documented. It's not me saying it, farmers say it, producers say it. It is absolutely the case that European businesses no longer buy from the UK because it is too bureaucratic, it's too much cost, and there is the greater possibility of delays. So why wouldn't you just buy from your own internal markets?
That is not what I've come to believe. If you have a good product, I'm getting
texts from people right now who say that it is true.
When I go to Germany, you know what I hear? English music. They love English music.
What's that got
to do
with anything?
They can't speak any English. I'm just saying, we export tons of English music.
Europe. What's the fact that the Spice Girls or the Beatles were brilliant got to do with this?
I'm just saying, our export could be music.
I'll tell you this, and I hear what you're saying, but I'll tell you this. With regards to music, as I've just been saying, we had pre-Brexit one of the most successful musical touring industries anywhere in Europe. Probably the absolute best. These days, and I've interviewed these people, I've interviewed the artist managers, I've interviewed the people who run it, they say it has become a nightmare for all of the bureaucratic reasons that I described. So, yes, we've got all these brilliant things. Thank goodness we do. And that's not to say that they will all now just go out and be bust because we're out of the EU. That clearly hasn't happened, although there are businesses that have gone bust. But the point is that they are now doing what they're doing that they did before, and it is harder for them. There's extra economic inefficiency, there is extra cost, which over the long term is making them less competitive vis-a-vis their European partners.
Here's the one thing I would say. Look at Canada. They put all their eggs in the basket of the United States, and now they're going around trying to get it to the rest of the world.
Well, they're trying to get a closer trade deal with the EU.
Yes, of course, because they were too connected to US. So here's a perfect example that, you know, it's better to have a much broader range of trading partners than be so reliant on one trading partner where you're the junior partner.
All right, Troy, you got the last word on that. Grateful to you. Troy and Crawley there, who's, in fairness, Tim got a different, in his company, got a different experience compared to other business owners, and that's entirely fair enough. I think it's fair to say that other business owners have had different experiences, and doubtless we'll hear from a few of those. As well, time's 10:32. Let's get the latest RBC News headlines with Dominic Ellis.
Wes Streeting has been accused of making a bid for the Labour leadership after hinting the UK should join a customs union with the EU. Sir Keir Starmer recently ruled out the idea, which has prompted political rivals to claim Mr. Streeting is losing focus on his brief as health secretary. Separately, Wes Streeting says he doesn't want resident doctors to strike a single day next year after they return to work in England this morning. Mr. Streeting says talks with the doctors' union remain open to prevent further industrial action. And the government has set out what it says is the most ambitious animal welfare strategy in a generation. Under the plans, puppy farming and trail hunting are set to be banned in England and Wales. LBC weather, dry and bright for most. Some outbreaks of rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland with a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
My beans have been to Mexico. They once went to Peru. My beans, they flew to Portugal, then went to Tuvalu. My beans were with me in Italy, then came with me to Greece. I slurped their sauce on Spanish shores. I nibbled them in Nice. My Heinz beans have seen the world. They've traveled far and wide because they are, as we all know, too good to leave behind.
Okay, let me stop you there, sir. You still have to check them into the hold.
Oh, right then.
honestly.
Beans means Heinz.
When your favourite celebs strut their stuff. When the underdog rises to the occasion. When you can't believe the judges' scores.
Wow, that was fantastic.
Wish I could pass a dough bear like that.
Well, for starters, you could pass a dough's bickies.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels, so you can enjoy every twist and turn of your favourite reality show. Search TV licence together.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
The dance floor!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2 for 1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
You've arrived. Your dream holiday. You got there for less thanks to comparing flight prices on Kayak. An idyllic local restaurant nestled in the cliffs. A peaceful pool with your own private sunbed. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare flight prices from hundreds of travel sites and bag a great deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 10:35. Lots of you getting in touch on this question about the customs union. Jason says, take us into a customs union reform will surge to over 40% at the next election. Ian says, why have you ignored the fact that Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in Europe but got drugged out by the vote in England? Well, we haven't gone through every single permutation. I mean, it is a news show. This event did happen 10 years ago. I don't think it's probably shocking to that many people who listen to this on a regular basis that Scotland did indeed overwhelmingly vote to stay in the EU. But there we go. We've said it again anyway. Beatrice says, let's go for a customs union with the EU. Stuff the US deal. It's not worth the paper it's written on, as has been demonstrated by the US recently ducking out of a promised IT investment deal. The UK's relationship with the EU is worth so much more to the UK economically, socially, politically and for security. Let's turn to Nigel, who is in Wandsworth, who has something to say about this. Nigel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Not at all.
My nickname with my Spanish friends is Brexit Guru.
Right.
Because I used to do imports and exports.
Are they your friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, what is Spanish for Guru? I'll look it up. Anyway, go on.
Guru, it's the same.
Guru. Guru. Okay, go on.
Just said it a different way.
Yeah.
So what has happened, like, after Brexit and all the implementation, because it wasn't straight after, is, like, years later, they've been implementing the rules for imports and exports. They've set up inspection rooms and that, which are starting to kick in and come into place. So far, I've only had one inspection, so that's not the issue. The issue is that before, if you wanted something from Spain, you placed an order, you got the invoice, they prepped for collection, transport picked it up, and it just came here, end of process.
Yes.
Right? Now, if you do an order, we're just talking a pallet, so this affects mostly SMEs and not the large businesses that are doing trailers. Yep. So they've got special permission, you know, they've got the little green dot on the van, they go straight through, they don't have any trouble.
Yep.
But the small businessman that needs supplies to make their things, where we export honey, and we've got like 24 clients here, and they, when they make an order, they set off a process that involves more people than meets the eye. First, the seller has to have someone who knows the system in Spain for the new export rules and regulations for Brexit and the rest of the world on that, but mostly for Brexit. We are a case unto our own, according to the other European countries. So they've got to hire a person to fill out all the paperwork, has to go to the vets, has to go to export customs. This paperwork costs money, causes delay. The transport companies now have to go through this process as well, so the cost of transport has tripled. It doesn't take 3 to 5 days like it used to. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks. Hopefully nothing goes wrong, and it's about 3 times the price. Now, what's the real problem here is you also have to have someone in England to do the paperwork, especially if it's a food product.
God, what a nightmare.
You have to go through DEFRA, which is where I come in, because the way they've set it up, once the order goes through, they then need to send me the paperwork that needs to get sent. And I have to wait until the transport literally give me the number plates of the van.
Oh, my God.
Right? And then
And all this was supposed to stop bureaucracy and red tape.
Literally, I'm disabled, so I'm actually like not officially working. So right. I only do this for two old clients.
Yes,
and that's an agent would normally charge around about £700-800.
So Nigel, I mean, so the conversation you would have heard the exchange I had with Troy, and maybe heard what I said before Troy, where I was actually basically describing a lot of the processes that you experience, particularly for someone who's exporting a foodstuff. But Troy was sort of saying to me that actually it's no more difficult than it was before, or barely more difficult. Your experience would suggest otherwise.
Well, how is that placed? Because before I just shoved it on the lorry and kicked it out.
Well, here quite.
3 days later.
Well, quite. And this is the other thing I think people don't sometimes, and we never, maybe it was the media's fault, I don't know, but like sometimes this is hard stuff to explain, right? But I think this is the other, I think, difficulty. Anyone who knows, who exported to the EU before and after Brexit knows the difference here, which is that, you know, it wasn't a trade deal that we had with the EU. It was more than that. We were part of a single market. It's actually called in the EU documents the internal market, just like the UK has got an internal market, right? So for all intents and purposes, it wasn't perfect, there were some differences and so on, but for all intents and purposes, the principle was supposed to be that it shouldn't be harder to export your honey from, I don't know, wherever you are, from London to Penzance than it would be from London to Porto, in principle. That is not the case now. We've got a deal, a trade deal, which is far, far more rudimentary and basic, the sort of things that you have with other countries.
Exporting is like five times more complicated. Exporting is a nightmare. And there's one thing that you did say that I would like to add on. Remember you said about taking the sound abroad and having to pay £400?
Yes.
And then bring it back?
Yes.
Well, guess what? To anyone, dog lovers out there, pet lovers, the pet passport that we used to have is no longer valid.
Yes.
If I want to take my pet with me to France or Spain or anywhere that with me, it's still the same paperwork, only you have to pay £400 to £500 every trip. It's no longer a passport. And it's actually the vet does exactly the same paperwork as they do to get the dog's passport. But if you had a passport before, you can't use it. If you want to go, like for 2 weeks, you've got to pay not only for the flight of the dog, but you've got to pay an extra £400-£500 for his temporary certificate passport. Now, that should have been a no-brainer. It's the same paperwork, so you have the same... I don't understand it. It's literally trying to make things difficult. And obviously, people are profiting from this.
Indeed.
Because now, you know...
Well, it's an absolute cottage industry for the bureaucrats and the red tapers out there. Nigel, grateful to you, and very, very important corrective, I think. And this is the thing. Nigel alights on the thing that sort of always annoyed me about the Brexit conversation. It's sort of like being exhumed from within me now, sort of buried it sort of in a vault deep, 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 deep within my psyche, because I sort of talked about it every single day when I was a political correspondent during that time. But the thing that always I could never get my head around, and the thing that irritated me, is that, you know what, a lot of the people who were the fiercest advocates of Brexit said that they were, you know, libertarians, that they hated the stodgy statism and the bureaucracy and the red tape. And so do I. In many ways, I'm a libertarian as well, certainly a liberal in all sorts of different ways. And I care about sovereignty too, but generally speaking, I care about the individual sovereignty, the freedom of individuals and businesses, more than I care about some abstract, abstruse notion of state sovereignty. And the weirdness, one of the many ironies of the Brexit settlement, is that we as individuals and businesses are less free, less sovereign than we were before. And the states in which we're in, the governments in which we're in, have more power, are more sovereign than they were before, because they can tell us, with far greater alacrity and far greater freedom, what to do with our lives, as we've just heard there from Nigel in Wandsworth. All of the endless direction and the form filling and what you have to do and where you have to send it and where you have to be and when, etc., etc., etc. A bureaucrat's dream and an individual's nightmare in terms of their own autonomy and liberty and freedom. And that's what the settlement that we have is. It is an absolute dream for the pen pushers. Lynn is in Bognor Regis. Lynn.
Oh, hello, Louis.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank
Merry
you.
Merry Christmas.
And a very Merry Christmas to you as well, down in Bognor Regis. And what have you got to say on this?
Well, I was going to try and introduce a bit of history.
Oh, please.
I, re- I I remember when Neil Kinnock was leader of the Labour Party, he used to quote a Welsh poet who said, "He who forgets his history lives in the slough of slavery." And that's exactly what we've done to ourselves in Britain. The 2016 referendum was sheer insanity and ignorance. And the reason that I know that was that I went to work for EFTA in 1966.
This is the European Free Trade Association.
That's right. I'm 82 now. Ah.
You went to Brussels for EFTA?
No, it was in Geneva. I was in Geneva. It was wonderful.
Oh, lovely.
It was a wonderful time. But I was head of the statistics department, and we did a study on what had happened to the UK and other EFTA countries' economies since the European Economic Community had started in 1953.
Yes.
We did this, EFTA started in 1959. We did this study round about the time that Harold Wilson made his pound in your pocket speech. If people remember that, that was when we had to devalue the pound.
Yeah.
That was the So we did this study, and it just proved absolutely 100%. How much our countries were suffering from the fact that we weren't in the EEC. And as a result of this, partly, it was part of the evidence for joining the EEC in 1973, and confirmed in 1975.
Do you think that the politics of this is changing again, Lynn, having, you know, that broad sweep of historical experience? Do you think the politics is changing around this?
Yes, it certainly is, and I do hope they get on with it. Because, I mean, in those days, we never thought about sovereignty, we thought about the economy. And
Lynn, just to build on sort of what I was saying before, I think that we got very bound up in questions around sovereignty during the referendum. We're actually, and I think this is one of the differences in the 1970s, during the 1975 referendum, if you want to be a bit more historical. 1975, people were talking far more about freedom. Freedom, as I say, for individuals and for businesses and for students. And you know, what use is sovereignty? What use is sovereignty? I mean, when you're sat there filling in your 600th bit of paperwork, or when you decide not to export your goods to the EU in the way you did before, if you decide not to travel in the way you did before, or if you decide not to be a student because it's no longer accessible to you as it was before, you're going to sit there and think, oh, well, I may be less free, but thank goodness I'm sovereign.
And I worked for the EU. I worked as a translator for 25 years for the European Union after we left EFTA. And so I couldn't have done that job if I was British now.
No,
I could only do it because I was a member country. I lived in a member country.
Yes. Lynn, in Bognor Regis, grateful to you. I am struck by how many texts we're getting from people coming in talking about how it's affecting their businesses and how difficult it is. And I think maybe we haven't talked about this maybe enough just generally, because there's been a feeling that, you know, whether we liked it or not, Brexit has happened and that's it. And politically, as I say, it's been put in cold storage. The actual day-to-day effects maybe not getting as much airing as they should have done. Anthony texts, say, "Hello, Lewis. I don't know if you read this out, but I deal a lot in classic car parts, and what used to be a very easy to ship from the EU is now more than doubled. For example, the door for an old Fiat Panda," I didn't think I'd be saying Fiat Panda on the show today, but there we go, "is €35 in Italy. The cost of shipping used to be €100. Now people won't ship unless you'll pay €500 to do the paperwork." And loads and loads equivalents of that. We'll try and get a few more before the end of the hour. We're also going to be talking about this proposed ban on pig and chicken cages being another blow for British farmers. That is with the president of the National Farmers Union. That is coming up. You're listening to Lewis. I was about to say Sunday with Lewis Goodall here on LBC. I'm too used to saying that. No, Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien this Monday on LBC. The time is 10:47.
This is LBC.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to That's brilliant. So, okay, sales targets. Are we hitting
the dance floor? Party time! Woo-hoo!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice move, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
At Lidl, get our deluxe Winter Wonderland Chocolate Village cheesecake with gooey caramel chocolate ganache and a crumbly base. Only £6.99 with Lidl Plus. And it's Good Housekeeping Institute taste approved. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus GB only, subject to availability. Selected stores, terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lbtv. Ends 24th of the 12th.
Gift more for less when you shop at the O2 this Christmas. Save up to 70% off RRP on over 60 of their favourite designer brands, including Nike, Tommy Hilfiger, Le Creuset, the cosmetics company store, and Lindt. Ticked everyone off your list. Start the festivities at one of our 30 bars and restaurants. Enjoy a movie or get competitive with bowling, climbing, interactive football, indoor skydiving, and more. Find us at North Greenwich, just 15 minutes from central London. Search outlet shopping at the O2 to start planning your visit.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Top up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
TRIP. Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Imagine your dream holiday made possible by comparing cheap flights on Kayak. Walking on an unspoilt goes on for miles beach on the Sardinian coast. Plunging into the splendor of an idyllic lagoon in Greece. Ah, yes. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare prices from hundreds of travel sites and airlines to find your dream deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:50. Piero is in Leatherhead. Piero, you've had your own experience about the effect of Brexit on your business. Is that right?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Not at all.
First of all, well said, the lady before me. She was absolutely brilliant.
Lynn, yes.
And she knew her stuff. Because a lot of people who voted for Brexit have no idea what they were voted for. Okay. So can we talk about imports rather than exports?
Please.
Because the UK, after all, imports much more from the EU than exports to the EU.
Indeed we do.
In fact, I found out yesterday, I was in Turin and I was looking at the Stellantis figure, you know, the company that owns Peugeot, Fiat and so on. And you know how many Jaguar were exported to the EU from the UK? 45.
Mm-hmm.
45 Jaguar. Right. I hope John Redwood is listening. Anyway.
I fear he may have switched off this slot some time ago, Piero, but you never know.
Well, it's with us 6 o'clock in the morning, so it doesn't get much sleep. Anyway, as I was telling your producer, I had 2 galleries in London, one in Grayson Road and one on Fleet Street.
Right.
And I was representing Italian artists. Basically, we sold modern bronzes and some sculpture made of glass and sand.
Okay.
After Brexit, I phoned Elio Garis, who is one of the main artists, and I said, Elio, can you send me some stuff? So he inquired with shipping companies. I went to the post office and so on, and nothing could be done unless he spent an absolute fortune.
Right.
So I wasn't able to carry on with that part of my business. The business I had before was catering, and suddenly after Brexit, everything shot up. I used to go to markets, to Covent Garden in New Spitalfield, and everything had gone up so much.
So to be clear, Piero, in terms of your art business, Brexit ruined it effectively.
Absolutely ruined it, killed it. Also, I knew a lot of antique dealers. Okay. Who on Friday night went to France to the various markets and they bought mirrors, you know, the usual antiques that the English like so much, French antiques. And to load the van, and they used to come back, go to Portobello or Fulham, wherever the store and shops were.
Now it's impossible.
Now it's impossible. It's unbelievable. And the other thing I'm very, very upset about is Erasmus, which has been re-established, thank goodness.
Yes, it has been. That's the student exchange program, of course. Piero and Leatherhead there, grateful to you. And again, I think it's really important. I think we've maybe averted our eyes, our gaze a little bit since the sort of Brexit settlement was established in 2019, 2021, partly because it has been so fixed. But it has had all sorts of economic consequences across all sorts of industries. This was one of the fallacies of Brexit at the time. Its most ardent proponents, entirely legitimate thing to believe and want, by the way, but it was always rested for me on the one fundamental logical difficulty, which is proposition one. The EU is this massive institutional, political, economic, social, cultural, intellectual force on our lives. It has taken over our country. Proposition two, it'll be really easy to leave and everything will basically be unchanged. And that does change will inevitably always be better. Those two things just never could go here. But anyway, we're going to talk about something slightly different for a couple of minutes now. This is the proposed ban on caged hens, apparently being a thing of the past in England. The government's announced it launches a new package of animal welfare rules, pig farrowing crates, which I must confess, before I read about this morning, I had not heard about before. Campaigners have said are cruel. They'll also be banned under welfare changes. These are cramped crates used to stop pigs from rolling over, crushing their young. But once in them, sows cannot turn over or move around at all. Conventional battery cages banned in 2012, but campaigners say this has caused the rise of so-called colony cages. Battery cages kept each bird in a small wire cage. Thousands of these cages stacked side by side. Larger cages hold colonies of hens, known as colony changes, and those have been allowed. But farmers are unhappy about it. Let's talk now to Tom Bradshaw, president of the NFU, the National Farmers Union, of course. Tom, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I think perhaps many people listening to this, listening to the descriptions, those descriptions there, would welcome them being banned. Why would they be wrong?
Well, I think particularly when you look at pig farrowing crates, there is an element here about trying to protect the newborn piglets to make sure that they're not rolled on by the mothers at birth. And so making sure that we don't dive from one system into another, which doesn't mitigate the issues around the birth of those pigs, and trying to make sure that we maintain as many of those piglets as healthy piglets as possible, is really important. There's also a huge element of cost here. And making sure that there is a transition period where we can invest in these new systems of production is really important, so that transition can happen. But I think more worryingly, we are concerned about whether or not our trade standards will genuinely meet our domestic standards. If we went back to 1999, when we banned the stall and tether ban on for sows, so they were used to be tied up in their crates. Now, it was right to ban it, but we implemented it immediately. The European Union didn't. And we used to be 80% self-sufficient in the pork we produced. But now we're producing only around 45% of the pork that we consume in this country. So we've exported our industry overseas to those European countries that didn't implement the ban in the same way that we did. There's a real danger here that our trade policy is looking to reduce inflationary pressure on food and isn't going to uphold the high standards of animal health and welfare that British farmers are so proud of. And so the balance here between making sure our trade policy is representative of the way we want to produce the animals within this country is critically important. Making sure that farmers have the money to invest in the new systems and the confidence to invest is crucially important. And also making sure that the decisions are science and evidence-based, so that we don't have any knee-jerk reactions, are all really important parts of any transition.
I mean, is there anything in the animal welfare strategy, which of course also includes bans on trail hunting, which has been getting a lot of attention today, is there anything that you do welcome? And what do you make of that proposed ban on trail hunting?
I mean, we're here to represent the food farmers and growers, the food and farming industry, and I'd really like to focus on those elements. But I think what we're seeing at the moment is that we're producing less poultry here in this country because we're increasing our welfare standards. We're reducing the number of chickens per shed. And all we're doing is drawing in more imports from Poland and the Ukraine that are still in those cramped conditions that we've decided we don't want here. We're also importing battery eggs from hens kept in battery conditions from the Ukraine. We can't have this out of sight, out of mind attitude where we simply...
So is that right? So battery farming is banned in the UK and has been since 2012, but it is legal to import battery eggs from other countries.
It is, absolutely, at the moment. That is the situation. And so we have to make sure that our trade policy really aligns with our domestic standards. And if it doesn't, we are simply going to export our food production to other parts of the world that we have absolutely no control over.
I wonder, Tom, since we've got you, you may have heard on the show this morning, we've been talking a bit about the EU and Brexit and customs union. Actually, a lot of people working in the foodstuffs industry, farming and so on, getting in touch. What's your experience in terms of what your members, farmers, tell you now about sort of some years on how the Brexit settlement is working out and exporting their goods to the EU?
I mean, we know that our trade volumes with the EU have fallen by over 30% since Brexit. That isn't the foundation for getting the best returns for the products that we produce. Importing plant materials from the EU has got incredibly difficult and is a real concern for our horticultural producers. But we also have concerns about realignment, particularly around things like plant protection products, gene editing, where we are no longer completely aligned with the EU. And we need to make sure that we don't have our hands tied behind our back, and that we need to keep access to those technologies where we have already diverged. So I think there are opportunities of a closer trading relationship and reduce friction at the borders, but we need to make sure that at the same time, we try to take advantages of some of the opportunities which have come about since we've left.
So one other thing as well, Tom. Obviously, there's been, with this government since it came to office, I think it's fair to say it's got a fractious relationship with farmers, or many farmers don't much care for it. There is this ongoing discussion, which is about, obviously, because it's about to come in, with inheritance tax on family farms and on farmers. The Prime Minister suggesting to MPs on Monday he had already spoken to farmers at the liaison committee, who told him that some were contemplating suicide. Do you still think that there is any prospect of a retreat on this?
I just don't see how the government can live with those human impacts. I'd met the Prime Minister on the Friday before he was in front of the liaison committee on the Monday. And I told him firsthand the very serious conversations, incredibly worrying. You know, the conversations I'm having with some elderly farmers, because they simply cannot mitigate the impacts. They don't expect to live for 2 years, let alone 7 years, to be able to make use of the gifting rules. And I don't see how the Prime Minister can deal with those consequences, or the government. I don't believe that the policy change intended to have those outcomes. And I believe that they have to work with us to try and mitigate the worst of those impacts. So, look, we will still absolutely be pushing for change in the new year. I think they're really struggling to defend that elderly sector of the community, which raises 75% of the revenue from this tax change. They've trapped that elderly group, and it is completely unfair. And I do believe they will have to change.
Do you think that the government's relationship, this government's relationship with farmers, is recoverable?
Well, I believe it is. I don't think it's been an easy 15, 16 months since they've been in government. But then we've got plenty of challenges that we've been dealing with for the last 10 years. But to start rebuilding that relationship, they need to make significant changes to the inheritance tax proposals. And then they can try to get onto a firmer footing. But at the moment, unless they make that meaningful change, then it is just about going to be impossible to rebuild the relationship with the farming industry.
Tom Bradshaw there, President of the National Farmers Union and the NFU, saying that it is a prerequisite for the government to retreat on its inheritance tax proposals on farmers. That is something so far they have not been shown much sign that they are willing to do. Doubtless another big political issue for 2026. In the next hour, we're going to be talking, yes, of course, about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and why he is still not fit to be a prince, but potentially fit to be king. The time's 11:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Wes Streeting has been accused of making a fresh bid for the Labour leadership after hinting the UK should join a customs union with the EU. Sir Keir Starmer only ruled out the idea a number of weeks ago. It's prompted political rivals to claim Mr Streeting is losing focus on his brief as Health Secretary. Speaking to LBC only last month, he was forced to deny claims he wanted to replace Sir Keir in Downing Street.
I think this is daft, to be honest. In fact, I think someone in Downing Street has been watching too much Celebrity Traitors, and this is just about the most appalling attack on a faithful I've seen since Joe Marler was banished in the final.
Separately, Wes Streeting says he doesn't want resident doctors to strike a single day next year after they return to work in England this morning. Mr Streeting says talks with the doctors' union, the BMA, remain open to prevent further industrial action. Health experts have warned, though, that the impact of the 5-day walkout will be felt into the new year and beyond.
Australian police claim the gunmen accused of the Bondi Beach shooting threw undetonated homemade bombs at crowds. New court documents submitted by officers also claim that the pair carried out shooting practice in the countryside days before the attack. The family of a woman killed by a drink driver are calling for immediate driving bans for those suspected of causing death by dangerous driving. Lily Clack, who is 22, was seriously injured in a crash on Christmas Day in 2021 and died 3 days later. It later emerged the driver of the car she was in was allowed to keep driving in the year before he was jailed. Lawyer David Preston represented Lily's family and has told LBC a change in the law is needed.
It's horrific to think that the person who ultimately killed your daughter is still driving around in a car when they've lost, you know, the biggest part of their life, and they're dealing with all the consequences of that. And I think in some of these cases there is going to be a need to suspend the licence of the person who has caused the injuries, though it does need to be balanced against that person's right to be able to drive and to have a fair trial.
The government has said there's already strict penalties in place for those who are caught drink driving. And the American whiskey brand Jim Beam says it'll pause production at its main distillery for all of next year. Spirit makers in the United States are facing higher costs as other nations retaliate against President Trump's tariffs. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 39 at 98.57. The pound bought $1.34 and a euro 14. LBC weather, dry and bright for most to date. Some outbreaks of rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland with a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11.05. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC, sitting in for James O'Brien, up to and including Christmas Eve. Ho, 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 you lucky things. Someone who has, I think, had less of a lucky year, although, frankly, it's hard to imagine where the last time he thought he might have had a good year is, of course, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Someone who, until this year, still had, was the Duke of York, still was Prince Andrew, still was part, albeit a distant part by that point, of the royal firm. Now he finds himself exiled from the family, although it still has to be said, living on royal property and on some level, we believe, at the expense of the king, and therefore on some level at the expense of us, because no one has ever been able to delineate to me the difference between private and public when it comes to the royal family. They are, to get a little bit Louis XIV about all of these things, the state, and the state on some fundamental level belongs to us. But Andrew now finds himself a ghost at the royal court and a ghost in British public life. And it is a ghost nonetheless that cannot be ignored, because as we saw over the weekend, we see yet more photographs of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor as part of the newly released cache of Epstein documents, or the Epstein files. Former Prince Andrew at Sandringham, lying across the laps of five elegantly dressed women as Ghislaine Maxwell looks on behind them. Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein in these photographs on a shoot near Balmoral, the three of them peering down from the royal box at Ascot. The images, as I say, part of the Epstein files released by the US Department of Justice on Friday. Snapshots taken at the most exclusive VIP locations require, basically provide further proof, if it were needed, that Charles had no choice but to strip him of his titles. And quite frankly, that this was the least that could potentially happen to him. Because, of course, he remains, despite it all, in the line of succession. He is not fit, apparently, to be a prince, but theoretically, at least, he is fit to be a king, because Parliament doesn't seem to want to do anything about it. And I want to make two arguments and have two sort of points of conversation in this hour of the show with you. One is about the narrower one, which is precisely that, whether Andrew, what possible legitimacy, what possible reason there there can be, given everything we now know, everything that might yet be released, the fact that he may be dragged or forced or compelled in some way. They can't do it legally, but he might feel he has no choice but to testify before the United States Congress about what he knew about Epstein and his role in that affair. Something, of course, he continues to deny to this day, all of the allegations that are put against him. Despite the fact, all of those things, that apparently Parliament does not want to do anything to remove this man who we believe is not fit to be the Duke of York, is not fit to have lots of obscure and pointless titles that were given to him, but is potentially fit to be the king of this country if some disaster were to happen. And even if not some disaster, then the very fact that with everything that he is accused of, and the fact that the royal family have effectively on some level believed he has said that they believe he has something about which to be ashamed by stripping him of all of these titles, because if they didn't believe that, why would they have done it? That this man, just as a point of legitimacy, can still be in the line of succession. That I can go on to the royal family website right now and see his name there, despite the fact that we know all of the things that he is accused of, and on some level, the royal family have conferred that they believe he has something to be ashamed of because they have stripped him of those titles, yet he still is in our royal line of succession. I want to talk to you about that, but more than that, I want to talk to you about the royal family itself. We talked in the last hour about whether the politics of Brexit are shifting. I wonder whether we might look back on 2025 and maybe what is yet to happen in 2026 as a moment when the calculus of the politics around the royal family in Britain shifted in a fundamental way as well. Perhaps this was always going to happen in the long years after the Queen's death and the loss of that ballast of the royal family. Although it's almost kind of forbidden or verboten to say it. But the Queen herself, the late Queen, of course, her role in protecting Andrew, and who knows, the money that she's given to him to pay for his legal battles and so on over the years, also probably deserves more scrutiny than it is received. But I wonder whether Prince Andrew reminds us of something fundamental, and the fact that he is still there, day after day, with everything that he's been accused of, still on some level part of the royal firm, has serving and is serving to remind us of the fundamental folly of monarchy overall. And it's something that was put much better 2.5 centuries ago going on for by Tom Paine when he wrote his book Common Sense. He said this: one of the strongest natural proofs of the folly of the hereditary right in kings is that nature disapproves of it. Otherwise, she would not so frequently turn it into ridicule by giving mankind an ass for a lion. What does he mean by that? Well, he means that with hereditary monarchy, with having a family which is bred to rule, is bred to be the state and to embody the state, then you are just as likely to get a knave or a fool or a crook or something worse than you are for a hero. For every Elizabeth II, you get a Prince Andrew. For every Elizabeth I, you get a mad king like King George III. For every hero, you can get a fool or you can get something worse. And I wonder whether Prince Andrew is a living embodiment of that, that we are all relearning that lesson again, because for so long we had someone, for 70 years, the longest stretch, longest reign in British history, we had someone who so perfectly seemed to embody the role of constitutional monarch, who, sometimes a bit of a cliche to say that she never put a foot wrong, but the common perception was that Elizabeth II never put a foot wrong. And yet, as long as Andrew is around, even without the titles, even without being prince, he embodies the absurdity of that system, that you never know what you're going to get. You're always going to get the roll of the dice. Again, for every Elizabeth or Charles or William or whatever it happens to be, if you like any of those, what else do you get? You get a sorry lineup of people who clearly on some level the royal family destroys. You get a Princess Margaret, you get a Prince Andrew, you get people who in whatever way seem to be ruined partly by this institution. And then there's another question as well, and this is the thing that I think you can't avoid with these Epstein pictures. These Epstein pictures don't reveal a hidden conspiracy. What they expose, yet again, is something more banal and yet more damning. And it's this. It's about how power works. It's about how power is worked and lent and laundered in this country in plain sight. Prince Andrew was nobody. He was a thicko royal. That's what he was. He was a thicko royal who, as far as anybody could see, yes, he had some distinguished record in the military. But he, beyond that, once he'd left the military, didn't seem to do a great deal. No one knew what to do with him. They gave him a trade envoy job. They gave him this. They gave him that. How do you solve a problem like Prince Andrew? He seemed to believe he was a man who believed far more in his own abilities than nature might imply or than what he deserved. He wasn't involved in running Epstein's operation. He didn't need to. He was valuable to Epstein because what he gave Epstein was legitimacy. He gave Epstein legitimacy because of his name, because of his blood, because of the House of Windsor. And that was something that he was born in. And what is really disturbing, and I think should make us think about our monarchy, what's really disturbing is that basically Epstein was aided and abetted by our name, because it's our royal family, by our country. His relationship with Andrew conferred a legitimacy on him. It opened doors for him. It gave him access to power and to people and to places that this man from whom most people and about whom most people had never heard. That's why he liked Andrew. Did he like him personally? Maybe he did. We don't know. But he liked him. But if he'd been some fella he'd met on, you know, walking down Fifth Avenue in New York, would he have liked him as much? No, of course not. He liked him because he was a prince, and we gave him that title. He traded off not just his name, not just his blood, not just his whatever he did day after day, but he traded off us and our name and our country. And I wonder whether we should use this as a moment to seriously rethink our relationship with our own royal family, whether it needs to be changed. And for all of the nonsense that is talked about, tourism and the stability it brings and all of that sort of stuff, ask fundamental questions as to whether that is the case. It doesn't seem to be bringing us much stability right now. Andrew is an ongoing diplomatic sore between us and the United States, and God knows we don't need any of those right now. The question isn't whether at this point Prince Andrew broke the law. That is for others to judge. It is whether he should ever be allowed to lend legitimacy to anyone at all, whether he should be still in the line of succession, something that still gives him legitimacy. Why Parliament can't get it off its backside and legislate to remove him from the line of succession, which they have done with kings and princes before. And also, whether we might not think very, very, very seriously about whether we should let others use the royal legitimacy, our name, to aid others in the future. Whether this is a system which needs fundamental reform or maybe even abolition. 0345 6060973. 0345 6060973. Is this a year, the coming year, when we rethink our relationship with the monarchy? Courtesy of the former Prince Andrew. It's 11:16.
This is LBC.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to dive into the crystal water of an ancient cave pool in Mexico, or dry off in the sun on a white sand beach in the Maldives, or pour yourself into the culture and chaos of a night market in Thailand. Seize the sale. Book in store and online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected travel dates apply. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com/terms.
Aldi's Christmas Super 6 fruit and veg. Top of the tree for freshness, quality and price. At just 5p each, white potatoes, carrots, parsnips, Brussels sprouts, cabbage and swede, all British. In store this week. Aldi, multiple fruit and veg retailer 2025 at the FPC Fresh Awards. Products and prices may vary, subject to availability.
My beans have been to Mexico. They once went to Peru. My beans, they flew to Portugal, then went to Tuvalu. My beans were with me in Italy, then came with me to Greece. I slurped their sauce on Spanish shores. I nibbled them in Nice. My Heinz beans have seen the world. They've traveled far and wide because they are, as we all know, too good to leave behind.
Okay, let me stop you there, sir. You still have to check them into the hold.
Oh, all right then. Honestly.
Beans means Heinz.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 11:18. I can see some people complaining about the description of Andrew as a useful idiot or a thicko royal. I think that is putting it mildly. Andrew didn't have to be malicious or to be dangerous. He just had to be careless or entitled enough to believe that his presence carried no consequences. In reality, it carried enormous ones, because every appearance they ever made with Epstein or anyone around that was a signal. Every dinner, a validation, every smile was basically he was being used by Epstein. And that is the sign of a useful idiot. Whatever he did or didn't do, and he denies all of this stuff, then that's fine. But he was used. He allowed himself to the end to be used. And there is now credible evidence that when, for example, he spoke in 2019 to my colleague Emily Maitlis about the extent of his communications after Epstein was convicted, that he lied about that, or he wasn't sufficiently forthcoming about that. Calling Andrew a useful idiot or a thicko royal is not an insult. It's a description of function. Epstein didn't need a genius. That was the last thing he needed. In fact, it wouldn't have worked. He needed someone like that. And he allowed himself to be used. And this is the point. Andrew could have been king. He could have been king. If Charles, there's that famous accident where Charles nearly died in that ski slope accident, whatever it was. If he had that happened before he'd had children, Andrew could have been the heir apparent. Now, you can have a question, a sort of nominative question or deterministic question about whether his life might have been different and whether he'd have made different choices. But the fact of the matter is, as I say, hereditary monarchy is the roll of the dice. It's about who you get and when. And if you're listening to me and you disagree entirely with me and you think we definitely need a monarchy and we need people like Andrew and you don't like what I'm saying, I just kind of want to know from you why I'm wrong and why the system as it currently exists is okay. Because we had so little control over what Andrew was doing. No one was even noticing it, but he was using the British royal family, our country's name, to confer legitimacy on perhaps the biggest paedophile who has ever lived. He said he didn't know that, but one way or the other, that is what happened. Why am I wrong? 0345 6060973. What is it about us, the British public, which so resists the idea, which so many other countries carry on very well with, the idea of a republic? Why do we constantly need to doff our caps to people who so consistently prove that they are unable to embody the best values of the British state? 0345 6060973 is the number. A few people have texted through. Sue says the system guards against the loonies having power. However, they do enjoy unearned privilege. The system needs to be streamlined and cut back. However, a constitutional monarchy must always be preferable to an all-powerful, deranged president. Alice says, I can't think of a time when I've ever disagreed with you, Lewis. Get rid of the lot of them. And Rob says, Lewis, I'm 70. I've never seen the point of the monarchy. It is not the time we came into, the 21st century, and not dwell in the 19th century. The only institution that should rule this country is a good government. Linda is in Berkhamsted in Hertfordshire. I think there's something to say about this, Linda.
Yeah, what I think is that it needs to be looked at completely. The money it costs for us, everyone else is being asked to cut back, do this, do that, and I can't see the benefit of it at the moment. They don't pay income tax like the rest of us. They don't have to pay anything when they die. It's all goodwill, and the time has come for that to change. Kids don't even know about them. If you go take kids to the Tower of London, it's 20 quid for them to get in to look round what really they own. So I just think we can't keep saying pensioners, do away with the pensioners, triple lock, and yet we're paying these people more and more. And the David Dimbleby three-part programme, I think, really says it all that's currently on BBC One.
The answer that's always put, Linda, is that they generate more money than they take away because people come visit the country and all that sort of thing.
I think that's a load of rubbish, and I think...
People still go and visit Versailles. I mean, the French haven't had the Bourbons for... Well, they had them back briefly, but they haven't had the Bourbons for over two centuries. But people still go and visit the Palace of Versailles in France.
Exactly. It all needs a rethink, and they need to contribute to everything. And they also, kids don't even go to the House of Commons to work out, what politics are. There's so much more kids need to know. And yet we spend all this money on state banquets, doing up Buckingham Palace. Nobody lives there. They all live at Windsor. I mean, they just do not understand the average Joe's life. And it's about time action was taken to make them contribute more to living here amongst us all.
Do you think that, Linda, the politics of this is changing? I mean, it was always said, I mean, that the British royal family, the Windsors, who are very alive to public opinion, they're very sensitive to public opinion because they know that is the thing on which their legitimacy, insofar as it exists, rests. Consent from the British public. Do you think that that is changing, and is Andrew sort of part of that?
No, I don't think it's changing that much. William's supposed to be looking at the homeless, but I think, I'm not sure, but I think it's been said that William doesn't intend to say how much tax he's going to pay where Charles did. And I believe Charles is the first king to be a billionaire. So I just wonder why you wouldn't, if you cared about the people and the homeless situation, kids living in poverty, food banks, that you didn't say, do you know what, let's hold back on some of that money. And apparently they can override anything that's written up. It can go for everyone else, but it doesn't have to go for them. I mean, what sort of position are we all in that we have to abide by some people who don't have to do anything? They literally don't want to.
Do you think that that Parliament should change the line of succession, Linda, and remove him from it? Because at the moment, he's eighth in line still.
Yeah, absolutely. And they should. It's all sort of died a death as far as politics are concerned. And it needs, you know, it needs to be looked at, the whole thing. And he shouldn't even be anywhere near where he could have a say on anything.
Linda,
I don't know if it was a privilege. I met him once at the TUC, and the people that I was with, I don't want to name them, he came over and said...
He was at the TUC? What was he doing, Lost?
Yeah, he was... No, it was quite a few years ago now, and that made my mind up even more. And when he was trade something or other, and
yes, he was trade
envoy. Our group. Yeah, and he came up to our group and he said, you chaps are having a bit of a bad time at the moment. And one of the people with me said, well, how would you know? You've never worked a day in your life.
Correct. Linda in Berkhamsted there. Archie is in Waltham Forest. Archie, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. Merry Christmas to you. Perhaps not the most festive topic, I understand, but, you know, nonetheless, here we are. It's all right. In the next hour, we'll do kind of, you know, how much of Christmas crack has gone up in price or something like that. But for now, we'll stick with this.
Yeah, so what I'm, as someone who's studied politics for a long time, and obviously this is part of politics, I watched the David Dimbleby documentary recently.
Yes, I haven't watched that yet, but I must watch it, yeah.
So there was a really, a pertinent point that really stood out for me about the whole concept. I disagree with having them, so I'll put that stall out at the onset. With a bid to make themselves more relevant, the royals are trying to appear like us. You know, with the baseball caps, the beards, the goatee, the, you know, I'm down with the kids, sleeves rolled up. So why are you there if you're trying to be like us? What is the point of you as an institution? Right?
Well, yeah. Well, I suppose they're... Yes, I mean, look, this has always been the dilemma that they've had, right? Like, they've never known whether to sort of preserve the kind of the mystique and the magic of monarchy, not let the light in, as someone talked about, you know, almost two centuries ago about this stuff.
Yes.
Not the light in, or is that just a kind of anachronistic way of looking at it, and you've got to kind of show that you are more normal and you're still, you know, you're somehow connected with the people. But this Andrew stuff, I mean, it epitomises what nonsense that is, right? Because no ordinary person or anything close to it, particularly of a man of relatively limited abilities like Andrew, would have anything close to the access to the power and the privilege and the wealth that he enjoyed simply because of who he was. And that was used by people cleverer than him and probably far more malicious than him against him, and therefore as part of this entire sorry saga.
And I paraphrase quite an interesting quote/story that is quite a few years old now, but it was about Prince Edward. I think it was his driver or his bodyguard got higher A level grades than Prince Edward, and he didn't get to go to Oxford. And it's a funny story. I can't remember the exact details, but it just struck home that, you know, I have teenage kids. I'm telling them that you can be anyone you want to be if you work hard and try your best. Well, you can't, can you? It takes away a meritocracy concept from 21st century Britain. Why, you know, why are you there?
Absolutely. Do you think that the politics is changing? Just briefly, do you think it is changing? Do you think that this Andrew, do you think it has made an effect in terms of people's perception of monarchy in the country?
I mean, I hope so, because with my kids' generation, my kids are 16 and 18, and their generation just have got nothing, no interest whatsoever in them. So you do wonder if it will filter through, because obviously as the people that are monarchists sort of slowly slip this mortal coil, whether it will become, kids will see, why, what have you got that I haven't got?
Yeah.
Just by accident of birth. I think, I hope so. I really hope so.
Archie in Waltham Forest there. And I just, before we just go to the news, I want to try and sort of crystallise why I think this is a problem and why I think it's amazing the deference that the royal family continues to get as an institution. I think it's genuinely astonishing. We don't know anything really about their finances. They're the most opaque in terms of their finances of any constitutional monarchy in Europe. They're the most extensive, and they have endless privileges that we don't even begin to really consider. I'm not necessarily against the principle of constitutional monarchy. Other countries do it better than we do. They do it without the opacity and the kind of nonsense and the deference and the doffing the cap and all of that sort of stuff. They perform in Norway or Sweden or Denmark or the Netherlands. They perform a useful constitutional function. But just consider for a moment the opacity of the money for the royal family alone. Remember that Prince Andrew, formerly Prince Andrew, did not face a public trial over the allegations made by Virginia Giuffre. He did not do that because it is reported there was a very large settlement running into millions of pounds to the Giuffre family. He did not submit himself to any open scrutiny, continues to deny the allegations, but nonetheless, that money was paid. That was some. That scrutiny that never happened was enabled by the fact that he was a royal and he had royal wealth. I'm sorry, that is a two-tier moral system. It just is. It just has to be. For most people, serious allegations, risk exposure, there's consequence to it. For the powerful, if you're a royal prince, basically you can ring mummy up and she makes it go away because it was reported that she helped him pay those costs. And even if they say the royal family insists no public money was used to pay that cost, but even if no public money was used, the monarchy's wealth only exists because it has a public role. Most of its money derives from the crown estate, which is ultimately owned by us. Most of its money comes from things like the Duchy of Lancaster, which is ultimately owned by us. So whether that wealth, you can say, is directly public or indirectly public, when it is used to resolve allegations that go to character and judgment, frankly, the cost has been socialised to us. We're paying it. We're paying it, not them. And on some level, we helped, all of us, we helped those allegations go away for Andrew, which he continues to deny. And I find that deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And it is not something, for all of the problems with democracy, that you would get with a democratic politician. Why am I wrong? And does the case of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor show that we should get rid of, or at least substantially reform, the monarchy? 0345 6060973. Time is 11:31. Let's get the latest RBC News headlines with Dominic Ellis.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, is facing renewed claims that he's plotting to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership. It's after Mr. Streeting hinted in an interview the UK should join a customs union with the EU, something Sir Keir ruled out 2 weeks ago. Separately, Wes Streeting says he doesn't want to see resident doctors strike for a single day next year as they return to work after a five-day walkout. The Health Secretary says the strike, along with rising flu cases, has created the biggest threat to the NHS in England since he took office last year. And a major incident has been declared after a sinkhole opened up, affecting a canal in Shropshire. Emergency crews are at the scene in Whitchurch, but there are no reports of any injuries. LBC weather, dry and bright for most. Some outbreaks of rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland. A high of 11 degrees.
LBC.
The big day is almost here, and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork, cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play.
Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Caterpillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot, Bears! And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes!
Nuthatch Adventure Park!
The sun goes on and on and on and on!
Book now at nuthatch.com!
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Now, let me ask y'all a question. Are you ready to ditch the crowds and the cookie-cutter holidays? I'm talking quiet mornings spent by crystal-clear lakes, cruising across the vast landscapes of Canada and the U.S. at a leisurely pace, stopping at charming towns and saying howdy. Go deeper with littleamerica.co.uk.
Leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
I had a text here from Francis who says, Lewis, I don't know if you're right. Andrew is never going to get anywhere near the throne. So is it worth spending parliamentary time on removing him from succession? Francis, I think it is. I think it's got to be. Because I'm literally looking at the Royal Family's website under the line of succession right now. It says, line of succession, sovereign, Prince of Wales, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, Princess Louis, the Duke of Sussex, Prince Archie of Sussex, Princess Lilibet of Sussex, and then, after all that flummery, number 8, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Now, again, Andrew has denied consistently all the allegations that have been made against him. But the royal family took his titles away. On some level, presumably they must be saying that they don't entirely believe him, because if they did, then why would they be taking the titles away? And given that, how can it be, as I say, that he's not fit to be a prince and he's not fit to be a duke, but he's still there on our Royal Line of Successions website? And we're basically saying that he's still fit to be a king. I don't understand that. And I know it's symbolic. And I know that it's unlikely that he would ever be king, highly unlikely. But what is monarchy if not pure and endless symbolism? That is what the whole outfit is about. It is about prestige and regality and the appearance of power while possessing none. And on some level, by leaving him there, Parliament is saying he is okay to be there. And it wouldn't take that much parliamentary time to remove him from it. It has been done before. Just ask Edward VIII. We live not just in a constitutional democracy or a constitutional monarchy. We live in a parliamentary monarchy. We established a long time ago. It's us, our MPs, who decide who is in the line of succession, not some absurd divine hereditary right of kings. So let's get rid of him. Ray is in Vauxhall. Ray.
Okay.
Ray, good morning. Can you hear me, Ray?
Yes.
Ray, you're on the air radio, Ray. Your thoughts on this?
Oh, right. So I was wanting to pick up your wider point, actually, about the monarch's role and influence in legislative matters, particularly in tax, because obviously you were the sovereign grant, and how the Queen then negotiated with Tony Blair to reduce her exposure to tax, also to swallow up much of the UK seabed surrounding the UK coast. Which
yes, bizarrely, for people who aren't aware of this, just to explain, Ray, what you mean by that, because it sounds a bit sort of odd, but it is true that the royal family basically own the seabed via the Crown Estate and derive certain income as a result of it.
Yeah. Which they negotiated with Tony Blair at the time, yes. Which prior to that wasn't the case. And now, obviously, all the wind farms and et cetera that are set up there are all income going to the Crown. But even historically, that would be the case. Even now, the Crown is trying to interfere with legislation that the current government's putting in for reform of the Leaseholder Act, the freeholder leaseholder arrangements. And because they're the Crown is one of the biggest freeholders in the UK, as well as Duke of Westminster. And they're both appealing in the courts the legislation. So they are constantly interfering to suit their own, you know, needs for tax purposes. I don't have an issue against the having a monarchy in the first place. Personally, I'm not an anti-monarchist, but I believe that their ability to interfere with legislative matters should be radically reduced.
And I suppose the thing is, Ray, is that in reality, is that possible in our system? Because they do enjoy such deference, both within politics and outside of politics.
Well, it is possible. It just, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Tony Blair negotiated an arrangement with them. It could have gone either way, but, you know, he buckled on a number of things, I feel. You know, when the Queen passed away, she passed away tens of billions of assets to the King without any inheritance tax being paid.
I mean, their will, right? I mean, it's actually crazy. Again, it felt kind of verboten to sort of talk about this when the Queen died. But, you know, a monarch's will is sealed. We never hear who is in the will and where the money is going. I mean, I find that absolutely extraordinary. In Sweden and in Norway and the Netherlands, with their monarchies, their budgets are voted on every single year by the parliament and is line by line scrutinised. Every bit of public money that they're spent, those royal families. Why on earth couldn't we do the same?
Well, we could do a lot. I just think all the governments of the last, you know, two or three decades haven't had the backbone to push back on, you know, the crown, and when they have negotiated, right, the crown negotiated harder than the government has.
I agree. Ray in Vauxhall, grateful to you. James in Bradford has phoned in, I think, with a slightly different view. James, good morning.
I do think it always revolves around money, and I think a lot's lost on the cultural sort of perspective that the monarchy provides. You know, in modern politics in particular, there's a constant sort of ease and almost sometimes it feels like a necessity to sort of degrade what is, you know, the British nation constantly. And I think the monarchy provides a good, you know, cultural focus point.
But the royal family aren't the nation, though, are they? Are they, James? It's perfectly possible to criticise the royal family without criticising Britain.
Absolutely, they are part of the nation.
They're part of the nation, but they're not the nation.
They're a massive part of them. Well, nobody remembers who the German president is.
So what? Well, they will in Germany. They'll know them in Germany.
Yes, but that's what I'm saying. So outside perspective of your nation is massively important.
James, I think in a way you're epitomising kind of my slight, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm trying to understand it, so I'm sure it's on me, but I don't really understand the idea of saying that the royal family in Britain are synonymous. I mean, you wouldn't say that about any other institution. I mean, you wouldn't turn around and go, well, you can't criticise Parliament because they're the nation, they comprise the nation.
I think you misunderstand me there, James. I'm not saying you cannot criticise. I'm just saying there's an overall too much of a focus on the fiscal or physical money side of it that you can see. I mean, in terms of reform and as the previous caller was saying about the ability to hide things away, I do agree there's a lot to be had on that. But I think when you have this conversation about it, it's all too easy just to slip straight to the, you know what, we'll go into the full abolition side of it.
No.
And I think we just lack. The one thing that we've succeeded in doing, as per you called the previous hour regarding the European Union.
Yes.
We just seem to consistently degrade our institutions in this country and erode a tradition, not tradition for tradition's sake, but just tradition that...
Does it not disturb you? Does it not disturb you, James, this, that Andrew was able to use his name, his family's name, and therefore, on some level, the British state, our state, to aid Jeffrey Epstein?
It absolutely bothers me completely on a level, and I think Andrew should be removed from the line of succession. Absolutely, you know, as you said, we've got a precedent for it, and that should be
plenty of them.
Listen to, I mean, it's, you know, if the money has come from the monarch's actual private estate and not from that could be traced back to public funds, I don't really see any difference there from a private business using some to cover something up, because that's essentially what the monarchy is on a physical level. It is a business.
But it's a bit, yes, but it's a business basically, which is conferred with extraordinary monopoly rights, isn't it? Conferred by all of us. And businesses, most businesses, in fact, all businesses would have way more transparency about how they operate than this one.
Yes, but I mean, if you know anything about how businesses operate in the UK, they also really do not function with a high degree of moral integrity either.
Yes, but they're businesses, and shouldn't we expect something a bit more from our head of state?
I do, and our head of state, as far as he's concerned, I think he's performing fine. I think he's all the things he's done recently to complete strip Andrew of his titles is the correct
still allowing
thing
him still allowing him to live in royal property, still on some level it is reported supporting him financially, still allowing him to remain in the line of succession.
You're right, again, line of succession I think is something that should be changed, but I mean, in terms of sort of living in property, would you sort of expect him to throw him out on the street?
If he's got
no money tied to it whatsoever.
I personally
could not see if I had an extra property
I just find it funny, James. People saying that he's been. I just find it funny that people say he's been exiled. He's literally living in a house that the king can probably see from one of his houses.
He's had his title stripped. He's been basically formally denounced, hasn't he, by the monarchy?
He's been denounced, but it was the royal family who helped him potentially evade justice.
Yeah, but that's a foreign royal family headed by the late queen. King.
Well, in which case, well, then do you think the late queen's got something to answer?
I certainly do. I mean, as much as God rest her soul, I think she did good things protecting Andrew Wells. I think one of the worst things she did.
It's interesting. James in Bradford, or maybe you're Lewis, I'm not sure. James in Bradford there. Let's turn to Rich, who is in Anglesey. Rich.
Hi, Lewis, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good morning. What do you think about all this?
Yeah. Well, I'm a bit disappointed with James, you said there. I was older a bit, but it's just one thing I disagree with what you said earlier. You said for every Margaret, you get a Prince William. For every Prince Andrew, you get a Charles or whatever kind of. You said they're all as bad as each other. It's only Andrew that's kind of, you know, what he's.
Andrew is surely in a bit of a category of his own, isn't he, Rich?
I don't know. I think they're all as bad as each other. Honestly, they're awful people, and we're forced to pay for them. We pay £510 million a year for one family in London. It's an absolute scandal. I just can't believe.
There is an argument, though, isn't there, Rich? There is an argument to say, look, obviously, let's leave Andrew to one side for a moment. I think he does embody the dangers of hereditary monarchy. I think he embodies the dangers of how we do monarchy. Because actually, if we had been more like other European countries, all you really need is a sovereign and a crown prince or princess and their immediate family. He should have been allowed to go and sort of get his own job and do something unconnected with the state long ago. But leaving Andrew to one side. There are some arguments for constitutional monarchy, aren't there? I mean, people do feel an attachment. Well, no, but there are. You might disagree with them, but there are arguments for it.
Well,
let me just put a few of them to you. One is that they are above politics, or they can at least be seen, perceived to be above politics, that they embody a continuation, a lineage, in a literal sense, from one generation to the next. They're a group around that which the family can, or the nation as a whole, can cohere, and they can and do provide some element of stability of governance and politics when democratic politics can be fractious and disputatious and volatile.
So that justifies paying £510 million a year for one family.
Well, we'd have to have some head of state. We'd doubtless pay for them, and I'm sure it would be far less.
Well,
but
yeah.
I don't know.
The president of Ireland was elected. His office, the whole, everything costs £400,000 a year.
Look, of course. Although, in a way, you could say. I think I would probably say that maybe the arguments about money are some of the least compelling, for me anyway, because I just think, actually, if you sort of think that constitutional monarchy is a good thing, the monarchy is, there's always going to be a cost to a head of state. But certainly true to say, the way the royal family works at the moment, with these endless kind of hangers-on, that is certainly a problem. I mean, many people don't even know. If you look through the kind of line of succession, again, I've still got it up in front of me, half of them, most of the figures, will never have been heard of, although some of them will not receive the public money or the sovereign grant. Some will and some do, and that seems pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, and you know, the Queen's cousin, some lady in her 80s, we're paying for a palace for her in Richmond Estates. It's mental, and I just can't believe in 2025 people still fall for it. Look how offensive it is to us in Wales. We've got some guy from London who's never done a day's work in his life, and he's our prince. Some guy from another country, and we've got to pay him for the privilege. He wouldn't know one end of Wales from the other. It's so.
I mean, most people in this country, I think it's fair to say, Rich, will never have heard of Prince Richard, the Duke of Gloucester, who was the second son of Prince Henry, the Duke of Gloucester, and Princess Alice, the Duchess of Gloucester, the youngest of the nine grandchildren of George V, the nephew of Edward VIII and George VI, and therefore the first cousin of Elizabeth II. Prince Richard, again, a man I think most people listening to this about whom will never have heard, will receive some money from the sovereign grant to support him carrying out official functions if he does perform them. And that's pretty extraordinary.
It's unbelievable. See, to me, it's simple. There should be protests on the streets 7 days a week until our family disappear.
All right. And get off the fence,
people,
Rich.
People don't see it.
All right, Rich in Anglesey there, I think, has a fervent attitude in these matters, but that's what we like on LBC. You're listening to Lewis Cole singing in for James O'Brien this week on LBC. The time is 11:48.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Labour have been accused of launching a fresh attack on rural England by outlawing trail hunting. They say they are taking the action over fears trail hunting is being used to cover up the hunting of foxes, which of course is illegal. John Zincroy.
Now, we wouldn't go to Ethiopian tribes or any other far out forms of hunting and stop what they're doing.
Georgie in Market Drayton, what would you say to John?
He lives in Croydon. I live near Tribune Norton and knew exactly where I'm with the hunt. Why would you want to pull an animal apart? And I know.
No, this is trail hunting we're talking about. No one's defending
foxes. It is trail hunting, but do you think trail hunting doesn't go to real hunting?
John, come back to you.
There's no debate in these people, unfortunately.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Do you have a co-op card or membership number? In July, Co-op CEO confirmed that the personal data of all 6.5 million members was accessed in a major cyber attack. If you're a member, your information may have been exposed, and you could be entitled to compensation through a group action claim. Check your eligibility today at jointheclaim.com. It's quick, secure, and easy to do online at jointheclaim.com.
Aldi's Christmas Super 6 fruit and veg. Top of the tree for freshness, quality and price. At just 5p each, white potatoes, carrots, parsnips, Brussels sprouts, cabbage and swede, all British. In store this week. Aldi, multiple fruit and veg retailer 2025 at the FPC Fresh Awards. Products and prices may vary, subject to availability.
When you're smiling.
Don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
When your favourite celebs strut their stuff. When the underdog rises to the occasion. When you can't believe the judges' scores.
That was fantastic.
Wish I could pass a dobe like that.
Well, for starters, you could pass a doze bickies.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels, so you can enjoy every twist and turn of your favourite reality show. Search TV licence together.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:51. Few more of your texts on this question around Prince Andrew. Gareth says, Lewis is a former Republican. I'm now convinced that the monarchy is on the right course. Gosh, it's an unusual direction. It serves as a living thread to our past, and I believe Charles is doing a great job clearing a path for William, who will dramatically modernise the monarchy and bring it closer to a trimmed-down European model for royalty. David says, hi Lewis, as right and justifiable as it would be right now to reconsider our relationship with the royal family. It's not going to happen at a time when the leading party in the polls claims to be the party of sovereignty and is waging a war against the supposed erosion of Englishness. Their popularity illustrates how the public are wedded to these archaic views of heritage and nostalgia. I don't know, David. I think this stuff is changing. I think it's and particularly sort of generationally speaking as well. And Brad says, I think the situation with Andrew has highlighted their sense of entitlement. I really think, I would say they are fairly entitled, Brad. Yeah, I think probably all in all. A gold carriage will do that to you. I really think this is the beginning of the downfall. They're not special only because of their despicable history. And someone puts, got Michael, actually hits the nail absolutely on the head, says it really does feel like a generational divide, Lewis. However, how'd you win over dinosaurs like John Sopel, Mike? I ask myself that about many things every single day. Let's turn now to another story briefly and talk about social mobility. If you think of one thing with Keir Starmer and his politics, it would probably be his attachment to social mobility. You might not like the current cabinet, but most of them in some way do embody the social mobility, which it feels like it is becoming rarer. Many are from working class backgrounds, went to comprehensive schools, ended up going to, you know, top universities, and they are where they are today. Well, you may be surprised to hear, given all of that, that Keir Starmer has no coherent strategy to tackle entrenched inequalities and social mobility harming the life chances of millions of people. This is from the government's own Social Mobility Commissioner report, warned last week young adults in Britain's former and industrial heartlands are being left behind as a result of failed or abandoned promises by successive governments. And in an interview with The Guardian, the Commission's chair, Alan Francis, urged Starmer to outline a bold vision to tackle the defining social mobility challenge of our generation. Well, Alan Francis, the chair of the Social Mobility Commission, joins us now. Alan, thanks so much for being on the show. Is it that bad? You don't think that the government has any strategy on it at all?
Well, the lack of a strategy around social mobility isn't just an opinion, it's a fact. We haven't had a national strategy since 2011 under the coalition government. It wasn't a very effective strategy, and no government since that time has updated it, including this one. So that bit is just a straight fact. We don't have one. The more interesting question, in a sense, is what could a strategy do?
And Alan, actually, just before we go on that, I realise in a way, I sort of, maybe it's because it's something I care about a lot, but you sort of ban these terms about, what do you mean by social mobility? What do we mean by social mobility?
Well, that's a really good question, because there are different ways of measuring it and different definitions. The one that people very frequently focus on is called relative social mobility, and that's when you compare the outcomes of two people from different social backgrounds. So, for example, somebody from one social class compared to another and their chances of getting into an elite occupation. Our view at the Commission is, we've set the evidence out on that, there are always issues to do to improve that, but as a country we don't do particularly badly on that front, historically or compared to others. But there's other kinds of social mobility, like, for example, the problem of intergenerational wealth and whether this generation is getting better off than the last. The problem of left-behind communities, which is a significant issue around regional inequalities. And then there's other associated problems around public confidence in social mobility and having effective policies to improve it.
And as you say, the interesting question, it's a matter of fact, as you say, that there hasn't been a strategy for a long time now. What do you think would and could be in that strategy, and what would make the biggest difference?
So the current commission has been looking a lot at the issues around social mobility as it affects different people in different places across the country, and regional differences stand out massively. One of the characteristics of our country is the dominance of London economically, and for many social mobility champions, getting people into elite jobs in London has been a key part of their strategy. But the question then becomes, what do we do about the rest of the country? For us, that is economic primarily. Education is important. Families and other things are also important, but it's fundamentally an economic thing. We think it's about having a more innovative economy, spreading innovation into places across the country, and really building place-based strategies.
It does feel like, Alan, it does feel that we've sort of, for a while, we used to call that regional policy. For a while, it was right at the centre of politics with the sort of levelling up agenda. It does feel that those regional inequality questions seem to have slipped down the running order of politics a bit.
They certainly have, and so has the link between economic growth and social mobility. And yet this year, the Nobel Prize winner for economics is a guy called Philippe Aguillon, who writes about exactly that. If the economy is innovative and creates opportunities for more upward mobility, it can lift everybody, but also create that open elite, which we want to see, with opportunities spread across the country. So it's combining those two views that we think is absolutely key to improving social mobility in the country.
Do you think, and this is something that whenever you talk about these sorts of subjects, Alan, the thing that obviously most concerns lots of people, particularly parents, is a real concern, which I think has become really embedded, that the generation coming up now, Gen Z, but also Gen Alpha below them and below that, will simply be worse off than their parents and not enjoy elements of social mobility is part of it, but also just the wider economic opportunity that they may have enjoyed. How certain do you think that is right now?
Well, in certain parts of the country, that's already the case. You know, one of the problems we've got is that our economy is so lopsided in this country that we've got areas where there's acute and persistent and ongoing disadvantage. And in those communities, they're, you know, measured in an absolute sense, the whole of our society is getting better off. But we're also starting to see some real problems around housing, wealth transfer, access to really good opportunities and jobs across the country, where those are significant problems. But they're solvable problems. And they're problems which actually, with a coherent strategy over a long-term period, we could address effectively.
Obviously, just finally, I mean, the thing that is perhaps most worrying at the moment and is most germane to this is that we are seeing real collapses, particularly in some sectors and some employment markets, of entry-level opportunities for young people. That's in the grad market, but it's not just in the grad market as well. Some of that's technology, some of that's AI, some of that might be government policy and a wider economic downturn. But given what we know about youth unemployment, which will have a permanent scarring effect on social mobility over the course of the working life, this has got to feel like a particularly worrying moment for the issues you care about.
Absolutely, because we're going to go through another phase of very great disruption in the economy through new technology and so forth, which is why we place innovation at the centre of our thinking about social mobility, because what we really need to think through is what kind of education, what kind of family support, what kind of place-based evolution do we need to make the best of that and give people the best chances of making it work well? It is going to be a very disruptive phase, and unless we learn the lessons of the past, so for example, the lessons of the 80s and 90s when we saw deindustrialization in large parts of the country, and we didn't do enough to address those issues, then we need to make sure this time we don't get that make the same mistake again.
Alan Francis there, chair of the Social Mobility Commission. One last word goes on the monarchy, and formerly Prince Andrew, goes to Alison Beeney, who says this: the monarchy was supposed to be a protection from a rogue government, but when the Queen was required to do this, she didn't. She allowed Johnson to prorogue Parliament, so what is the point of them? Alison didn't really get on to all of this. One of my pet hobby horses, absolutely incredible. The whole point of a head of state, sometimes they're supposed to step in constitutionally when the constitution is not being observed. And we have created a system where the head of state, the guardian of the constitution, on some level, on most levels, simply cannot do that because they are a walking, talking ornament. And what use is that to anyone? The time is 12 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the Health Secretary is facing renewed claims he's plotting to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership. It's after Wes Streeting hinted that the UK should join a customs union with the EU, something Sir Keir ruled out only 2 weeks ago. Conservatives claim Mr. Streeting is political pitch-making above his government role. But speaking to Lewis yesterday, the Labour chair, Anna Turley, said the Prime Minister has no issue with his cabinet.
I know that when he looks around the cabinet table, he sees the team that he's chosen, that he's handpicked, who are working with him, and he's, you know, working with them on their agenda, and they're focused on delivering for the NHS.
So the Prime Minister's not irritated by these interviews that Wes Streeting and others are giving?
I think the Prime Minister is totally focused on delivering for the people who've elected him.
Wes Streeting has previously denied trying to oust Sir Keir Starmer. Separately, Mr. Streeting says he doesn't want to see resident doctors strike for a single day next year, as they return to work this morning after a five-day walkout in England. The Health Secretary says the strike, along with rising flu cases, has created the biggest threat to the NHS since he took office last year. One of Russia's most senior generals has been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. Fanil Samarov was head of operational training for the armed forces. Russian officials say they suspect Ukraine was behind it, but Kyiv hasn't commented. A major incident has been declared after a sinkhole opened up, affecting a canal in Shropshire. Emergency crews are at the scene in Whitchurch. No injuries have been reported. People are being avoided to avoid the area. And an end to puppy farming and a ban on electric shock collars for pets are being promised as part of major animal welfare reforms by the government. Trail hunting is also set to be banned in England and Wales. The Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds says the practice is being used to cover up illegal fox hunting.
We're going to ban trail hunting, but the reason that we're going to consult on the detail of the ban is because we do want to make sure that there aren't any loopholes that people can use to get around it. Because I think in legislation, there are always problems with loopholes. You've got to really try and future-proof the laws that you pass. So that's why we're taking a little bit of time to get it right.
In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 46 at 98.51. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 14. LBC weather, dry and bright for most this afternoon. Some outbreaks of rain for Scotland and Northern Ireland with a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
You've arrived. Your dream holiday. You got there for less thanks to comparing flight prices on Kayak. An idyllic local restaurant nestled in the cliffs. A peaceful pool with your own private sunbed. Mmm, this is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare flight prices from hundreds of travel sites and bag a great deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12.03. So we're going to move on from that really controversial topic of the royal family and instead engage with a topic that I'm sure doesn't engage any polemic or doesn't engage too much bad blood at all. And that is, of course, the issue of reparations. And we're going to be doing this partly, not just because it's a really interesting idea in and of itself, but also because I think it's actually going to be quietly one of those issues that bubbles up in 2026. What do I mean by reparations? I mean, in particular, moves from African and Caribbean countries to push Britain and other Western countries to accept liability for and pay compensation to countries which were victims of the international, and in particular in our case, the Atlantic, transatlantic slave trade two centuries and more ago. Ghana's president, even in the last few days, John Dramani Mahama, is holding talks with a global delegation seeking reparations for transatlantic slavery and colonialism, urging other African leaders to choose courage over comfort and support the growing movement. It's a delegation which is made up of experts and leaders from Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, and basically part of a movement which looks like it is going to achieve some coherence at the Commonwealth CHOGM conference next year. Caribbean countries in particular interested in this, said to be looking to press Keir Starmer for payments from Britain for reparations to compensate the descendants of those who were victims of slavery. Indeed, the various Caribbean nations under the auspices of the Caribbean community, the CARICOM organisation, have been holding meetings with MPs over the course of the last month or two. First official delegations of the Reparations Commission from CARICOM to visit Britain. That happened a couple of weeks ago, with a claim that Caribbean countries could seek compensation of some £18 trillion from Britain as compensation for slavery. This is an issue which gets many, many people animated for understandable reasons on both sides of the debate. And there are clear philosophical and political and intellectual arguments, in fairness, on both sides of the debate. It's something that I discussed on my Sunday show yesterday with Marcus Ryder, and he's a CEO of the film and TV charity, but also co-author of The Big Payback, The Case for Reparations for Slavery and How They Would Work. He wrote that with Seleni Henry. I think this is a reasonable exposition, actually, the interview we had, of the arguments. He's obviously putting the arguments for it. I'm putting the arguments, because it's an interview, against it. And I think it kind of sort of fleshes out, at least to some extent, some of the arguments involved as the basis for a conversation between us. So I started by putting it to him that those who committed the atrocities against slaves just aren't alive today. And so I asked him what the moral argument can be for people in this country who are alive now paying for crimes they didn't commit.
The compensation for the slave traders when slavery was abolished, that compensation, because Britain took out a massive loan for that, was only completed in 2015. So that means you had the massive irony that the descendants of the slaves, myself, other black people, right, in our taxes, we were actually paying to compensate the very slave owners.
But the danger with reparations is you'd be doing so again, but compensating countries which aren't your own, because you live here now.
This is an argument that I think really devalues black people.
How? And
because when I do not hear this argument about, oh my God, poor Germans are paying, which they still do, pay compensation to Israel. Right,
and there are still people who are alive who were subject to the Holocaust.
But you're merging two arguments, right? One argument is, should nations, through their taxes, through other ways, pay compensation to other nations and other people that they have wronged?
Mm.
Right? That's one argument. And it does mean, because of taxation, that of course there'll be countries where there are poor people, where some of their taxes will contribute, just as their poor people in Germany.
But there must be some statute of limitations, mustn't there? Because, I mean, for example, should we be paying compensation for the Crusades, which were 8 centuries ago, or the you know, political entities which have long since ceased to exist?
So this is about making repair, right? So if we believe that the consequences of the transatlantic slave trade are still ongoing, which if you talk to all of the African countries, if you talk to the AU, if you talk to CARICOM, which is representing all of the Caribbean countries, and if you speak to many of the Commonwealth countries in Asia, they believe, right, that there is ongoing harm due to the transatlantic slave trade.
But they would have a reason, right, to argue that. I mean, they do.
Well, what's really interesting
is their countries would benefit.
But what's really interesting is that you say that, right? But at the same time, I never hear that argument with regards to, well, the Ukrainians would say that because their country would benefit. We are no African countries and Caribbean countries.
Ukrainians have been subject to that. I don't know. I'm completely sympathetic. And no one, as I say, and some people do dispute some of the facts. I certainly would never do that. It's very, very clear.
Do we believe in the continuity of a state?
But what we can, of course. But also, I think some people listening to this, say, if they were in Ukraine right now, might take issue with the idea that they are equivalent, because they have suffered now and are suffering today. And if you're sat, for example, in the Caribbean and you're doing pretty well, it's hard, I think, to make equivalent to a war of aggression that is taking place right now. I think some people would find that morally problematic, actually.
They may well do. I understand that. And I think that we need to recognise that the slave trade still has ongoing repercussions. And what is interesting is
they are more diffuse than, for example, the repercussions of Ukraine and what's happening in Ukraine and Russia.
Potentially, if you think with regards to the Bretton Woods agreements, if you think about the Bretton Woods institutions, which were built when countries did not have independence, and so it was that which, and if you think about standard lending rights to Caribbean countries and to African countries, and if you think about the world economy, these are ongoing problems, which is actually causing.
I suppose just finally, Mark, I have some sympathy for the moral arguments and the principle you put forward. I still think that it is difficult. You can understand if you're a politician like Keir Starmer, who I think suspect probably also has some instinctive sympathy for the arguments that you're putting out. But when he has to turn around to poor people in Britain today and turn around to them and go, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to put up taxes by 2p in the pound or whatever it happens to be, because we're going to, you know, be paying for the crimes of people who were 2 centuries ago. You must understand, that's politically tough.
This is so interesting. The vast majority of our conversation, right, has focused, which it absolutely did, when people were arguing against
Marcus,
the abolition of slavery.
I think that's a flawed way of looking at it.
Let me finish, please, Lewis. The vast majority of this conversation has focused on the financial compensation. Let me tell you what reparations are.
No, we've been talking about the principles.
So one is a cessation of violations. Mm. So we stop with regards to slavery. Two is the assurance and guarantees of non-repetition. Three is the idea of restitution. So that broader means to put the people who have been wronged back in the position that they might have been if they had not been wronged. Four is the notion of compensation. And five is the notion of satisfaction. That's symbolic repair. That's things like education. Right, of the five which are recognised by international law with regards to reparations, only one of them is about financial compensation. And yet, this entire conversation, right, well, has predominantly been focusing on just the financial compensation. And it was the same argument that was used to derail the abolition of slavery.
Well, that's partly because, Marcus, as you know, it's the Commonwealth leaders who want to put that issue of compensation on the table. That's the thing about which they're most interested.
That's,
but anyway,
that's not true, actually. That's not true.
Well,
it is true
in terms of the reporting that's been done at the moment with regards to Sholdham.
I actually believe it's true in terms of reporting. But if you look at CARICOM's 10-point plan for reparations, a full and formal apology for the transatlantic slave trade, an Indigenous Peoples Development Programme, funding for voluntary repatriation to Africa, the establishment of cultural institutions, the return of cultural heritage, the assistance in remedying the public health crisis, education programmes, the enhancement of historical and cultural knowledge and exchanges, psychological... No, but...
I'm afraid it's a conversation we're going to have to continue another time because we're out of time.
How much of their 10-point plan, right, is actually about financial compensation?
Marcus.
Very little. It's important, but it's not as important to make sure that 90% of this conversation is about financial reparation. It's exactly the same concentration that abolished when there were arguments against the abolition of the slave trade.
So that was Marcus Ryder speaking to me on the imaginatively titled Sunday with Lewis Goodall show yesterday here on LBC. He is the author alongside Sir Lenny Henry of The Big Payback, The Case for Reparations for Slavery and How They Would Work. And I think just in terms of, because it's not a term that outside of sort of statecraft and history we hear a lot, and this particular debate, I think Marcus is right to alight upon the etymology of the word reparation. It literally means repair. It is to try and repair damage that has been done. And he is right to say, and I know this will be controversial with many of you, but he is right to say that the academic studies that have been done do show that the slave trade, economically speaking, continues to have effects on some of the countries affected to this day. Just a few stats on this, and about, because obviously it was a long time ago, far beyond the realm of living memory. Transatlantic slave trade existed roughly for about 360 years, from 1501 to 1867. About 12.5 million Africans forcibly embarked. About 10.5 million of those survived. Mortality rate of about 14 to 15%. About 40% of those people came from West Central Africa and Southeast Africa. Of those who survived the crossing, about 40% went to Brazil, 35 to 40% in the Caribbean, British, French, Spanish, Dutch colonies, 10 to 15% to Spanish America, but only about 4 to 5% actually to British North America and the US. So over 90% of enslaved Africans were taken to Latin America and the Caribbean. But the economic effect was substantial. I mean, at its peak, enslaved Africans were Britain's most single valuable import by value. It allowed us to develop the economies of our colonies, sugar, cotton, tobacco, coffee, and the slave trade was accounted for up to 5% of British national income at the time. Not huge, but substantial. And there was a study that was done a few years ago which suggested that given some of these countries, large parts of Western Central Africa lost between 20 to 50% of their working age population over centuries, which produced consistent and persistent labour scarcity, lowered productivity in those countries, which continues to exist, the effects of which to this day. Indeed, one study suggested that African countries most exposed to the slave trade are today 50 to 70% poorer than they otherwise would have been. And therefore, the argument goes, and I'd like to discuss it with you and what you think about this, but the argument goes that therefore, given that on some level we benefited, and the argument goes we continue to benefit from that wealth, from that money, and those countries continue to disbenefit, they continue to suffer from not having those people and the economic lineage that that has had over the decades and the centuries, that therefore we do owe them something. We do owe those countries something, as complicated and as tortuous and politically fractious as it might be to work out. Would you be willing to have your taxes go to pay for compensation to those, the descendants of those who were enslaved by our ancestors 200 years ago? 0345 6060 973, 0345 6060 973. I can see here quite a good text before we get going with Robbie in Chelmsford, who says, Get your reparations bingo cards ready for William Wilberforce, Barbary Pirates, I Didn't Take Any Slaves, Romans, Vikings. How far back do you want to go? It's 12:17.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
This Christmas Eve, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Yes, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve. There's magic in the air, so get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Imagine your dream holiday made possible by comparing cheap flights on Kayak. Walking on an unspoilt goes-on for miles beach on the Sardinian coast. Plunging into the splendour of an idyllic lagoon in Greece. Ah, yes. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare prices from hundreds of travel sites and airlines to find your dream deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
Waitrose presents...
And the main event.
One cook learns that love... doesn't always shout.
Ain't that for me?
Sometimes it whispers.
I saved you the best bit, Dad.
Starring succulent number one free-range turkey bauble wrapped in dry-cured beetroot smoked bacon with cranberry jeweled pork stuffing and orange glaze.
Ooh, thanks.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Subject to availability and delivery slots available to order online and in stores from 19th of December.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345-6060-973.
Time is 12:18. We're talking about this question, which I do think is going to rear its head in 2026, of reparations for the slave trade. Lots of Commonwealth countries apparently wanting to press Keir Starmer on this, if he's still Prime Minister, of course, at the next Trogum Commonwealth Conference. View your text. Tess says, honestly, as a black man, born and raised in England, I don't think this will ever go ahead because historically people are frightened that black people have economic power. Before everyone gets on my case, I don't believe everyone is racist in the UK, but there will be inherent racism. I think that's an arguable test, although it does seem to have become more arguable in recent years. Mike in Martinique says, oh, that's nice, Martinique. Lewis, the most appropriate compensation should be changes to the education of the UK population to teach the truth, which would permanently enhance racial harmony and then provide... debt relief. I think that's a really interesting point, Mike. I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, there's a question about what we do about the past, but actually more germane for us in a way is what we do about the future and the present, right? And educating people properly and getting over the sort of hoary old cliches about this stuff and actually have, you know, but then what happens, of course, is you get into the endless turgid debate of people saying, oh, you're ashamed of our history, as if like learning more about your history can possibly ever in some way be tantamount to being ashamed of it. It's absolutely crazy. And John says, this is a joke. Okay, good start. It's a joke. Not a very funny one. How can today's taxpayers be held accountable for crimes committed 200 years ago by companies in the States? Quite happy for them to go after them, but not ordinary people whose ancestors were probably victims. John, I do agree with you. One of the complications about all of this sort of stuff is if you did have reparations, obviously, one of the weird anomalies would be we've had huge migration from many of the countries, the descendants of whom, from some of those slaves who were taken there, came to the UK over the past 60, 70 years, and they would end up in their taxes... potentially be paying basically compensation to others, despite the fact that their ancestors themselves were victims of the slave trade. And you would have poor people in the UK basically potentially handing over money to wealthy people in different parts of the world, like the Caribbean and so on. It does get knotty and complicated. You sort of take it out of the realms of moral philosophy and political philosophy, put it into actually how is this going to work in nuts and bolts, and it is difficult. It's not easy. Gemma is in Guildford, who I think has something to say about this. Good afternoon, Gemma.
Oh, I've waited for this conversation for a long time.
Oh, gosh, okay. I hope in a good way.
yes, I am a great-granddaughter of a slave.
Wow.
But I'm white.
Right.
Now... my great-grandfather... So
before we go on, Gemma, how did you find that out? Were you always aware of this in your family?
No, I've done... COVID was really good for me because I looked up all my heritage, but I've been aware of it from when I was tiny. I was very proudly... my great-grandfather was extremely dark-skinned,
right.
And he came across in the 1800s after the emancipation of Cuba and came over here and married a white woman from Warwickshire. And gosh. I've never heard of any racism in our family. No stories to tell other than good stuff.
Yes. But so how many generations are we going back then? So it's sort
He's only my great-grandfather.
What? But he came over... Oh, wow, okay, wow, okay.
So, I have a beautiful picture of him. He was a very good artist that he'd sketched in charcoal. So it's about 100 years old now.
Gosh.
Proudly sits on my wall with a picture of my great-grandmother. What I think is, where does it end? Where does it end? The past is the past for a reason. It has gone. Yes, it's awful what happened, but had it not happened, we wouldn't be the world we are today. And I think there are many people that had slaves, and it wasn't just us. There was Spanish took my great-grandfather's family from, I've got Western Bantu, Nigeria, and all sorts mixed into my DNA.
Wow.
So how does this work? Because at the end of the day, we're in a crisis in this country, and we need to be concentrating on education. We need to be concentrating on those that are racist. We need to be concentrating on beefing up those countries that were hard done by what we and other countries did. But at the same point, there are other countries now, China is one, who has slaves. They have people in prison camps.
Yes,
there are
indeed.
Saudis. I'm not sure it's the Saudis, so don't get me wrong. I might have to eat my words on that one. But there are people in Arab states that have no status because they are lower than the dogs in the streets. So where do they come into it? Who made them? Have they no rights? We all have rights.
I suppose the argument would be, Gemma. I suppose the argument. Look, as I've said, I'm sympathetic to some of the arguments that you put forward. I think that once you take it out of the realm of the theoretical and try and apply it practically, I think it's difficult. But nonetheless, I suppose that if you were an advocate of reparations, I can definitely see the moral case. But I suppose you would say, look, there isn't a statute of limitations on this stuff. This stuff happened. It continued to have real world consequences. And very often, countries that end up paying reparations are in a terrible state. You know, Germany after the Second World War or others now. And we don't sort of turn around and go, well, just because they're in a bad state about this, that and the other, that lets them off their obligations.
But on the same ethic, I've got a wonderful, wonderful person who looks after my mum who's from Zimbabwe. You could say now, if we are making reparations to those people in African states, they won't learn from it because at the moment they're currently killing their own countries by the stuff that goes with apartheid and everything else that went with it. They're not learning.
There wasn't apartheid in the Caribbean. That was the South African
thing. No, I'm not saying the Caribbean. I'm saying in Africa, because some parts of this came from Africa. My great-grandfather would have come from the Bantu and Nigerians and North Africa and whatever. So, you know, just talking about them, where does that start? Because if you want to pour money into those African states, it will just go on anything other than education. It will go down the drain because their own people.
But
are
isn't
not
that up to them? I mean, when compensate. I mean, if we just reduce it down to an individual level, obviously we get people to pay compensation to others all the time if they've wronged them in some way, you know, legally or whatever. But we don't turn around and go, well, what are you going to spend the money on? I mean, if you owe them.
Oh, I get that. But at the end of the day, I'd be welcome to have some compensation. But where do we draw the line? Because our country is so eclectic from all the years where people have come here and we've diluted ourselves to some extent. I'm still proudly English at the end of the day. I don't care. But I am extremely proud of my heritage, and it's made me and my family who we are today.
Gemma, grateful to you. Catherine is in Cambridge, who I think has something to say about this as well. Catherine, you're a historian, is that right?
Yes, Lewis. Yep, this is right up my street. And I kind of...
Is this in your academic interest?
Yes.
Ah.
Yes.
Excellent.
So I started to agree with the previous caller, and then it just went pear-shaped.
Okay, tell us how.
There is not a continent on this planet that this country did not rule over at some point or another.
Or part of the continent,
part of a continent in the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
From that, this country took gold, silver, rubber, diamonds, oil.
Many treasures that still are in the British Museum and elsewhere, of course, or in the crown jewels.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's not just to African people, Caribbean people, but this was like globally. Look at what this country did to India, to Ireland. It's all about education. People need to understand their history. It's not all about the money.
Mm. I would agree with that.
Intergenerational trauma gets passed on through generation. That's why people of colour have higher mental health conditions than
other races. Yes. It's about people learning, and by people learning the facts, then I don't think all this racism of hanging flags up from a lamppost will happen, because there's been some horrible things that have happened. And it's not something that we should all be proud of, but it's our history, and we need to learn about it so that we can move forward, so that we can eradicate racism, so that we can live in harmony globally, not just in this country, but globally.
As an historian of this yourself, Catherine, perhaps we can use you to elucidate on a few matters here, because something I can see already people are messaging in are saying, look, it's also true to say that many Africans, for example, let's take Africa, were sold to Europeans by African intermediaries or whoever they happen to be. So why should we, in which case, how do you begin to work the compensation out for that? Of course, the argument can be, well, there wouldn't have been a demand for the slaves if the Europeans hadn't come along and done it. But nonetheless, what would you say to that?
The reason slaves have always been prevalent in society. However, the slaves that the early Africans had, they were not chattel, in they were not
as we came to think of, for example, slavery in the United States South, which is probably the most vivid illustration of it.
But strangely, Lewis, that Britain introduced the slave trade to America.
Yes, of course, yeah.
But we forget about that. And it's something like when you see war movies from World War II, there were thousands, millions of black people fighting in that war, but we don't see those faces.
No, and they're not. And what we also don't show, for example, in the US Army, you don't see this in Saving Private Ryan and so on, but those squadrons, those platoons, those that were segregated. You know, there were black soldiers there, but they just weren't allowed to serve alongside white soldiers.
Yep. So my mother I'm adopted, but my adopted mother was a Cockney, born and bred. Mm. She moved out of London when World War II started, and she came to this area where there was a lot of American bases. She was told that the black servicemen were monkeys, and they hid their tails down their trousers.
Gosh, how disgusting. Well, Catherine, I mean, I think that just finally before we go, I think that you remind me of one of the things that I find funniest about this debate. And I'm actually quite conflicted about this. I'm quite ambivalent because I think that I can sort of see the moral arguments. But as I say, I think practically it's difficult. I actually really agree with you that I think one thing that we could address more is the present, which is how we come to understand these matters and not get into pathetic culture wars every time someone puts their hands up and say, well, not every part of British history is completely noble and wonderful and fantastic. But leaving that to one side, I always like it when people say, but we abolished it. I mean, so what? If you're doing something really bad, you don't get to turn around and go, oh, no, but I stopped doing it. You still have to, like, make account for the fact that you were doing it in the first place.
Yeah, no, we actually didn't. What we did was we told other countries they weren't allowed to have the slave trade. So British fleets would go capture the slave
trade. And we compensated the slave owners for it.
Yes, but then we took all the captured slaves, built Sierra Leone, put them there, and then taxed them.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that we can never forget, Catherine, who's in Cambridge, Merry Christmas to you, Catherine, grateful to you. The thing we never forget is that we did pay collectively for abolishing the slave trade. But as I say, we didn't pay a penny piece to anybody who had been caught up in that vicious, horrendous, vile trade. We paid, and actually, through the form of government indemnities and loans, for a long time, continued to pay to slave owners and the descendants of slave owners, who in a very real sense continue to benefit from that trade to this day. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC. We'll continue this conversation around reparations. Do you think that there is a case for Britain and other countries to pay countries who comprise mainly of people who were victims of the slave trade, pay them compensation, potentially trillions of pounds of compensation, over a long period, but nonetheless, trillions of pounds of compensation to make repair for our own role in the slave trade? Can it be right? 0345 6060 973. 12:31 now. Let's get the latest LBC News headlines with Amelia Cox.
There are renewed claims Wes Streeting is plotting to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership. The Health Secretary has hinted the UK should join a customs union with the EU, something the Prime Minister ruled out earlier this month. Separately, Wes Streeting says he doesn't want resident doctors to strike a single day next year after they returned to work in England earlier. Mr. Streeting says talks with the doctors' union remain open to prevent further industrial action. And a Russian senior general has been killed by a car bomb in Moscow. The Kremlin say they suspect Ukraine was behind Fanel Savarov's death, but Kyiv hasn't commented. LBC weather largely dry this afternoon with brightening skies, particularly in Wales and Western England. Cloudier by this evening, a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
The Lotto £15 million jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve.
You heard that right. Lotto's £15 million jackpot must be won.
Must be won?
Exactly. Must be won.
And very exciting news, it could be you.
Me?
Yup, as long as you have a ticket, you're in with a chance.
Well then, I'd best grab a ticket.
Lotto's £15 million jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve, or thousands of you will win a share of the prize. Get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Prizes rounded down to the nearest pound. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
The big day is almost here, and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork, cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
In a world where innovation meets style, there's a new name on the road. And right now, families like yours are discovering a car brand that values you. Feel the future in motion as the Emotify petrol and E5 electric blend next-level technology with real family life. With state-of-the-art features and advanced safety systems as standard, say hello to a car that fits your lifestyle and your future. Starting from £23,990. Book your test drive online now. Search Omoda to find your nearest dealer. Omoda, value everything.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
Just like when you amplify your advertising with radio. 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 12:34. I did talk about reparation bingo cards, courtesy of Robbie and Chelmsford. Well, I think we've almost got a full house now, consequently to a few of these. Mike says, hi, Lewis. What about reparations to the 1 million plus Brits taken from the western countries of England and counties of England and Wales by Barbary pirates over 2 to 3 centuries? Bingo! Mike, that's right. Yes, well, of course, yes, that is true. Barbary pirates did enslave people, but normally it was temporary. And I think it's fair to say that Barbary pirates, far smaller numbers be involved, and it was basically a tragic peripheral phenomenon, and it was not a system that in any way shaped Britain's way of life in a way that it clearly had for a long time, and some people will say continues to shape certain African countries' way of life, permanent scarring. Clearly what happened to the Barbary pirates did not permanently economically damage Britain in any conceivable way. Lilina says, the lady asks, where does it end? How far back do you want to go? Bingo! Yes, that's another one. And the truth is, Lena, of course, is that the argument is that there is something specific about the trade, the transatlantic slave trade. Because, you know, someone's talking about here, we've got, here we go, yeah, Rich says, Romans, Lewis, utter garbage, Lewis, black people always play the victim. Can I have compensation off the Romans for their invasion and the French for the Norman invasion in 1066? First of all, Rich, very, very offensive and unpleasant thing to say about black people always playing the victim. What on earth are you talking about? We're talking here about the slave trade. And the fact is, most of the victims, or nearly all of the victims, because it was a completely racialized system, were black. So therefore, that is why we're talking about them being victims, because they were victims. It would have been different if it wasn't a completely racialized system, which is one of the differences, by the way, between the transatlantic slave trade and other forms of slavery which have existed throughout history. We've got people going, you know, you've got people texting about this saying slavery has always existed. Yes, but it wasn't a racialized structure like the transatlantic slave trade was, which became completely embedded in and central to the economic structures of many of the countries involved, and certainly many of the colonies to which these people were sent. So you're comparing apples with oranges. You're comparing two completely different political systems. So I think we'll leave that one there, shall we? Glenn is in Weir, who in Hertfordshire. Glenn.
Yeah, like everyone's been saying, how far do you want to go back? Muslims, they conquered three quarters of the world years ago. Yeah? They enslaved people.
Three quarters of the world?
Yeah, they, yes. You go back and, well, three quarters of it. They, other than the Americas, most of the European countries, Muslims conquered most of it.
China, India, Australia, New Zealand, India, Canada, South America. Russia.
But then you can say about how far, most of Europe.
No, they conquered Spain and they got a bit of into France and then they got through Greece and the Ottoman Empire, but they didn't conquer most of Europe.
And they persecuted people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they and then killed them if they didn't follow their religion.
But Robbie, why
ain't they paying a compensation?
But Glenn, apologies, Glenn, like, but you just claimed that Muslims, I mean, this is an argument about history, right? And you claim that Muslims conquered three quarters of the world. Where?
Well, that's what they say.
Is this who
they? I'm only going on what they say in that Quran.
Right.
You can say that the Quran is lying.
Well, I'm not aware that the Quran does say that, Glenn. But if they claim that, then yes, like a lot of religious documents, it's probably full of things that aren't completely true. But I don't know why that has much relevance to this conversation.
And what about the Portuguese?
What about them? Did they conquer three quarters of the world as well?
No, but they walked straight through Spain, straight into Africa, enslaved all the slaves, took them back into Portugal and then sent them out across the Atlantic, straight into the Americas and over to us.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, if we're convinced of the moral case for reparations, which, by the way, I'm still pretty open about, but if we are convinced about that, then yeah, it would be subject to the Portuguese as well. They wouldn't be exempt. So when you answer your question, what about the Portuguese? Be like, well, yeah,
and
they'll have to pay.
And what about the Denmark with the Vikings? They come over here, enslaved us, persecuted us, and killed all the Druids and Saxons off.
Do we think that the execution of the Druids continues to have an economic impact on modern Britain?
Well, it probably changed my ancestry.
Well, you're here, so you clearly won particular battle.
It probably changed it, didn't it? You know? I could say that my forefathers were Druids.
Do you know that they were?
I don't, but you never know.
You never know.
So that's what I mean. How far do you want to go back? I don't think black people in this country are saying, oh, yeah, well, we deserve money off of England. We deserve money off of Portugal. I don't think black people are saying that.
No,
I think black
not
people
all will.
In this country just. I
some
don't
people
think,
will.
I think black people. No, I don't.
Some people do think that, Glenn, because some people think that Britain.
I'd say 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1 million.
Oh, well, that went up quite quickly.
Right. Yes.
Well, Glenn, thanks for that. I don't know if that stat was in the Quran, but I'll get someone to check. I'll get Eleanor to check. Kevin is in Finchley. Kevin.
Hi, just before I start, Glenn. When you have a legal, a query or case against someone, you don't look at all of the other people who you may be able to have a legal case with. You direct your query or your case with that person or that company or that situation where you're looking for a remedial solution. Okay, so this is like talking about Druids and Vikings. I am from Jamaican heritage, so. Obviously, the British owned the island and the British Caribbean. But where Glenn has a point is the Spanish actually had it until 1655. Mm-hmm. And obviously, then the British took it alongside Pirates of the Caribbean. So just give you a bit of a fact there. Actually, pirates would bombard the island. And so the British were able to claim Ireland in 1655. But, I mean, look, for me... You know, this conversation about reparations, it always gets very heated and you get people saying about the Vikings and
well, I have to say, I talked about the bingo card. I didn't expect to have my forefathers were Druids on the bingo card, but hey, here we are. Well, we'll add it in.
Exactly. Now, look, the fact is, is that if the British... You know, had a real challenging time, up until, say, only 40 years ago with, say, the Swedes okay, or the Vikings, Norwegians, and they were looking for reparations, I think everyone was saying, oh, fair enough, you know, go for it. Now, you know, I don't believe in a big cash payment because we can't afford it. Right. Yeah. So it's impossibility. Right. However, there was a hurricane recently in Jamaica. Okay, Hurricane Melissa. I can't remember how much we gave. I think we gave like £1 million or something ridiculous like this. I think there should be funds set up to support those Caribbean islands for whenever they have these disaster events that are going to happen again and again. You know, it doesn't have to be trillions. It could just be a fund, welfare fund. Other things you could do is, you know, FDI, so foreign direct investment, where there's a win-win for the British government. You know, they can get tax money from, you know, Jamaican tourism, which is huge industry. Okay, and then another thing they could do, which would help, you know, people off, you know, Caribbean heritage like myself, and I think this is a neat, easy one to do. Is lower my tax. I currently pay 40% tax, right? Lower it down to, say, 10%, okay? And, you know, that could be, I don't know, for 2-3 generations. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to have extra cash. I'm going to spend, you know, money in the UK, 20% VAT. The hit is minimal, but it is a real nice gesture to say, you know, we're sorry that, you know, we really impacted your ancestors and you, okay, because I don't have my surname. I have a Scottish surname.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't have my language. I don't know my culture. So it's not just like, you know, the Vikings came over and plundered. I've lost my whole heritage. It's gone. Now, that's fine because we recreated the heritage in Jamaica and Barbados and Trinidad, and we're grateful to be in the most beautiful islands. But a gesture would be reduce my tax down to 10%. I'm going to spend lots of money.
It would create such social division, though, wouldn't it, Kevin? I mean, really, I mean, I'm just thinking about how that would play out and about the sort of certain forces in society. It doesn't mean it might not be right in principle to do, but the political, I think that the political effect would be divisive, wouldn't it?
I mean, look, you know, anything we do is going to be divisive. There's just no way around it because you're going to have people who are going to be very upset with me even suggesting that, okay? But, you know, the fact is, you know, when we talk about slavery ending 200 years ago, it didn't really. Let's be honest, okay? It didn't properly probably end until, the division and the impact. Probably
the transatlantic slave trade, the purchase and the sale of slaves did end.
It ended, yes.
The effects lingered, of course.
The effects lingered. Even today, you know, I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but in Jamaica, a lot of the land, and the beaches in particular, are owned by the royal estates.
Well, indeed. I mean, well, that goes back to our previous conversation. Kevin in Finchley there. We have had a look, by the way. You won't be surprised to learn that we can't find a source suggesting the Quran says that Muslims colonise 75% of the world. If you are aware of one, then perhaps you could send it to the History Department of GB News for certification. Abdi is in Watford. Abdi.
Hi, Lewis. Hi.
Hello. You have something to say to our caller, Glenn, I think.
Yes, indeed. So I want to basically clarify the slavery, in terms of the slavery, Islam itself, the Quran itself, talks about the prisoners of war, okay? And as you know, before Prophet Muhammad came in, the slavery was very, very practiced in the Middle East or the Arabian Peninsula. And it was to do with mainly when Prophet Muhammad came in, when he says you need to take the slaves, it was basically to free them rather than to enslave them. So the practice in Islam is to take the slaves as a prisoners of war and treat them like your own family and then eventually free them. So it was elimination in a process of period of time. After a while, it was forbidden.
Right. Abdi, I tell you what, the line isn't brilliant, but I think we sort of got the gist of what you're saying. You're saying that the contrary to what we heard earlier, that slavery in Islam is that it's forbidden within the Quran. So you made that point there. We'll continue this conversation about reparations to see if we can fill in the rest of the bingo card. Full house, times 12:46.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Asma Mir.
Does your heart sink when you see young kids on the bus silently scrolling on social media? Or do you not mind? Would you support or not a ban on social media for 16-year-olds like Australia?
Asma Mir at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
When you're smiling.
Banning dental group clinics with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
This Christmas Eve, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Yes, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve. There's magic in the air, so get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Gift more for less when you shop at the O2 this Christmas. Save up to 70% off RRP on over 60 of their favorite designer brands, including Nike, Tommy Hilfiger, Le Creuset, the cosmetics company store, and Lindt. Ticked everyone off your list. Start the festivities at one of our 30 bars and restaurants. Enjoy a movie or get competitive with bowling, climbing, interactive football, indoor skydiving, and more. Find us at North Greenwich, just 15 minutes from central London. Search outlet shopping at the O2 to start planning your visit.
My beans have been to Mexico. They once went to Peru. My beans, they flew to Portugal, then went to Tuvalu. My beans were with me in Italy, then came with me to Greece. I slurped their sauce on Spanish shores. I nibbled them in Nice. My Heinz beans have seen the world. They've traveled far and wide because they are, as we all know, too good to leave behind.
Okay, let me stop you there, sir. You still have to check them into the hold.
Oh, all right then. Honestly.
Beans means Heinz.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to dive into the crystal water of an ancient cave pool in Mexico. Or dry off in the sun on a white sand beach in the Maldives. Or pour yourself into the culture and chaos of a night market in Thailand. Seize the sale. Book in store and online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected travel dates apply. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com/terms.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to
stay out all night? Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, okay, sales targets. Are we hitting
it? The dance floor!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2-for-1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous, from £70 with standard single-vision lenses.
Nice move, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is just approaching 12:50. We are almost, we've almost filled in our reparations bingo card. And there is one card that remains undabbed, or one spot that remains undabbed. So if you can remember the last remaining square on the reparations bingo card, text in and you will receive absolutely no prize whatsoever. But there'll be a certain sort of moral force to the whole thing, won't it? Talking about moral force, I will just say, I can see a lot of people messaging in very, very angry about all this sort of stuff. All of the stuff as well, there's loads of bile, racist bile associated with it, which does not surprise me, unfortunately, because it has just been normalised by X and so on. You might want to try just thinking about a proper argument against it, because there is a proper argument against it. And it's this, history should be context, not an invoice. And at some point, if you basically start saying that all crimes that are committed are hereditary, then where does that end? But the thing you've got to do, therefore, is to accept responsibility, not us, but our country. And every time anybody ever suggests something sensible about teaching reparations and these issues or talking about the slave trade, it just becomes instant culture war where you're accused of being ashamed of our country. Yeah, I am ashamed of our country in that regard. We've done so many brilliant things and continue to do so. But you know what? I don't take any pride in the slave trade, and I don't take any pride in the fact that we abolished it. When you're doing something awful, if you stop, you can, what's the point in taking pride in it? You were doing something horrendous. Anyway, reparations. With Natasha Clark, LBC political editor. Do you want to talk about that, Natasha? We've got something else to say.
I didn't ask Number 10 about what their thoughts are on reparations
today. Something next time.
Next time.
Has Number 10 been saying?
Yeah, so it's obviously we're on Christmas recess now, so Number 10 about to take a little bit of a longer hiatus from speaking to us journalists.
Merry Christmas.
I know, Merry Christmas, and they've just announced that they're going to be taking back all lobby briefings, which I'm sure you've seen, Lewis, being totally scrapped.
Good.
But we wanted to talk to you today about social media. So this has obviously been something that Keir Starmer is looking at very closely. What's happening in Australia, those bans to take away social media for under 16. Now, Number 10 is saying today they have no plans for an outright blanket ban. They say they will be closely monitoring Australia's approach. However, they do point us to some of the Prime Minister's words where he recently said, this is more about how you control the content that they see rather than saying a blanket ban. We will always listen to parents. Now, this is interesting, Lewis, because I think there is a bit of a debate going on in government about how far to go on this social media ban. You remember when Peter Carl was the Science and Technology Secretary? Mm. He, I think, wanted to go further. However, speaking to people in government over the last sort of few weeks on this, it feels like there is a bit of a row on how far to go. I actually spoke with Josh McAllister. He is the Children's Minister about this last week, and it is very clear from speaking to him that he wants to go further.
The government has been clear that the Online Safety Act was a first step and a really welcome one to make sure the online world is safer for kids. We do need to go further, and I'm working with colleagues across government to make sure that we can take further actions as necessary to keep children safe. I will personally be following what's happening in Australia closely and with interest. It's a world first, so it'll be fascinating to see the results of it. But I know myself and everyone in government who's a colleague of mine shares the concerns about children being exposed to harm online. The Online Safety Act is just the first step. So colleagues at the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology will be looking at further measures that can be made in future. That's quite right, because we need to make sure that as technology evolves, we're keeping up with it with our own rules and legislation. I've been campaigning on these issues for a number of years. I feel really passionately about it. And in government, what we're focused on is, you know, making sure the Online Safety Act works, but then also looking at how young people's world online can sometimes bring them to pretty significant harm. So as the minister responsible for child protection, that's pretty squarely my focus at the moment.
And one of the things I think they are looking at, Lewis, is the age of digital consent. Now, at the moment, obviously, you can get a social media account at, 13 for Instagram and Facebook and Meta. But they are looking about whether they, as a government, and this is something that other governments around the world are also looking at, whether to raise that age of consent where you can legally go online and say, this is my content, I have permission to do this, to post this content, up to 16. Now, that obviously would technically ban all social media for kids under 16. But I'm told they were following exactly what's happening in Australia. Obviously, it's got quite a backlash from some in Australia, but some parents seem to really love it. So, want to watch closely there.
And McAllister, we should say, I mean, he's a junior minister in the government, considered, I think, a bit of a rising star. He has been prosecuting this for a while and has wanted, and I know there are other Labour MPs think this, they think that it could genuinely be a winning political agenda for them to be seen to be reclaiming childhood, to being the force who is not afraid to use the power of the state online to protect children, because because obviously this is such a sort of big issue for so many parents. But they also think that many of their opponents, Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage, of a more libertarian bent, might not be willing to do the same, and they think they can hammer them on.
Exactly. And there's one person over the weekend that has also lent into the idea of a social media ban. Who can you guess? Guess who it is?
Go on.
It's Wes Streeting, of
course.
He's
in favour a lot, that lad, isn't he?
He is in favour.
He really is.
It does feel like, with that interview that he did over the weekend in The Observer, it feels like he's taking a step forward.
You don't want to wind your neck in, do you, Wes?
Oh, for sure. He does. Absolutely doesn't. He is very much setting out his stall, as one Number 10 source has put it, over the last few days. And there is nothing that Number 10 can do about it. And arguably, they're the ones that let this cat out of the bag, aren't they, with that sort of unauthorised briefing that we saw on Mr.
Well, it looks like that they're dancing to his tune this morning. because Starmer had said before, the Prime Minister said before, that he wasn't in favour of an outright ban, and is now apparently considering.
Well, like I say, if read into those comments that, that Number 10 said earlier today, they say it's more about how you control the content rather than an outright ban. So I think, even though they are saying the Prime Minister is looking at this, he will absolutely keep an eye on what is happening to Australia. I don't think at the moment he does. And I think you're right with what you say about reform and about other parties not wanting to take that sort of more radical authoritarian approach. And, you know, they're arguably, Number 10 are doing quite a lot of authoritarian things. Digital ID, restriction on juries. And that is something that Nigel Farage, and obviously lots of other political parties do have a legitimate attack on. But what Mr. Streeting is saying is, look, we've got to be better at bigger, radical ideas, or we're going to lose the next election.
Natasha Clark there, LBC's political editor. Let's round off our discussion on reparations, shall we, with Samuel, who is in Toaster. Samuel.
Hi, Louis. How
I've said
doing
that correctly, haven't I? People are going to think that I've just gone mad and I'm saying that you're in some sort of electoral appliance, but I am right.
It's pronounced Towchester.
Oh, is it? Oh, God, I thought it was the other way around. I was overcompensating. I thought it was Toaster rather than Toaster.
No, never mind.
There you go. So, yeah, people, never mind. Samuel, go on.
So, first of all, you know, for all these people, these keyboard warriors, people are phoning up and going, what about the Romans? This is why I don't phone. Because I know that that's what's going to happen when I listen to the radio. And some, most of the time, halfway through, I turn it off.
No.
So for people out there that send, you know, these messages and have kids or even, you know, you've got to imagine what it's like having your kids torn out your house, your hands, and raped. If you've got a boy, life expectancy, 25 years.
Right.
You know, everyone keeps talking about 200 years ago, 400 years. I wake up every day, Lewis, with the surname of the person who raped my great-great-great-great-grandmother. So that's today.
Hello? Samuel, are you still there?
I am.
Just repeat that last point briefly, if you would.
I can hear myself back in the voice.
I tell you what, Samuel, given that we've got that, you made your point extremely powerfully and pithily. Apologies for the quality of the line there, but you made it, and people will hear you and remind us of that extraordinary fact that so many people, descendants of slaves to this day, continue to have, because that was the custom of the time, the name of their owner, effectively. I think he may have been getting upset, which I can completely understand if that's the case, and brings home how real history can be. John in Edinburgh, the last word to you, John.
Hi. I think we fail to realise the continuing effect that the whole slave trade has on Britain. Number one, Britain did not just get rid of the slave trade without buying off the huge amounts to the slave owners in Britain. Now, the money paid across of those people was 7% of the entire economy of that year, or 25% of income of tax. In today's terms, that's £180 billion. It's enormous. It's not small change, even by today's standards. And it almost laid the basis, or funded the basis of the entire class system in this country. I know class existed before then, but it's a huge amount of money, and those families still benefit from that, continue to benefit from it. So if anybody's going to pay reparations, maybe they should.
Well, and indeed, it's actually an ongoing conversation with some of those families, John. I think one particularly notable family actually has done so. But anyway, it's a fascinating conversation, as I say. Grateful to John there. And one I think that will be a bigger theme of the next year. Brexit, reparations and the transatlantic slave trade. Don't let it be said we don't know how to have a Merry Christmas on this show. If you missed any of today's programme, you can, of course, listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date on the top stories and opinion, put your news categories in order that you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including The News Agents. I'm off to speak with that old dinosaur raconteur, John Sopel, right now to record today's edition and give a very happy 40th birthday to our editor, Tom Hughes. Happy birthday, Tom. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now, standing in for Sheila Fogarty, it's Asma Mir.
Lewis, thank you very much. Now, does your heart sink when you see kids as young as 10 or 11 on the bus on the way to school, silently scrolling on social media? Yes, we do that too, but we are adults and our brains are not being rewired to the same extent that young kids' brains are. We are less impressionable, you could argue. Is a relentless diet of reels and likes and scrolling ruining kids' childhoods? Would you support a ban on social media for under 16s, just like Australia? I suppose it boils down to this question. Is it time to legislate to give children their childhoods back?
on your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Tories have accused Wes Streeting of making a bid for the Labour leadership rather than focusing on the NHS. In an interview with The Observer, he appeared to hint Britain should join a customs union with the EU, which is not official Labour policy. LBC's political editor Natasha Clarke has more.
There's been sources that have been speaking to newspapers in the last few days saying that this looks like a blatant attempt to try and set out his stall. One said it's not even subtle. He's setting out his stall for the leadership. There's nothing Number 10 can do about it. But it's fair to say there are people in the heart of Number 10. And you'll remember that briefing that we had just a few weeks ago where we heard from the Prime Minister's allies that he would be prepared to fight a leadership challenge if one comes his way. Very much saying if you fancy a chance, come and give it a go. And
Mr. Streeting says the more he sees the demands of the Prime Minister's job, the more he wonders why anyone would want it. Separately, the Health Secretary says he doesn't want to see a single day of strikes by resident doctors next year. They've returned to work following a five-day walkout by members of the British Medical Association in England. The Health Secretary says talks with the union remain open to prevent further action. Australian police have alleged two men accused of carrying out the Bondi Beach shooting had weapons training days before the attack. Court documents also claim the pair recorded a video setting out what they called their justification for their actions. One gunman was shot dead by police. Another is facing 15 murder charges. Premier of New South Wales, Chris Minns, says reforms to gun laws are being considered with urgency.
This legislative change will be met with opposition both on the floor of Parliament and in the community. I've heard members of the public say that we've gone too far, but I strongly believe these changes to law and legislation in New South Wales are fundamentally important to keep this state safe.
10 people have been helped to safety after a 50-metre-long sinkhole breached a canal in Shropshire. Several narrow boats were left stranded and emergency services declared a major incident earlier. Large volumes of water also escaped onto land in Whitchurch. And the American whiskey brand Jim Beam says it will pause production at its main distillery for all of next year. Spirit makers in the US are facing higher costs as other nations retaliate against President Trump's tariffs. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 40 points at 98.57. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather largely dry this afternoon, getting brighter, particularly in Wales and Western England. Cloudier by this evening, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Asma Mir.
Good afternoon to you. This is Asma Mir on LBC, sitting in for Sheila Fogarty today and tomorrow. Welcome to the programme. It's 4 minutes past one. We're going to talk about something that you might have already bought as a Christmas present for your children, and that is mobile phones. It's not mobile phones per se. We're not going after them, but something that children use their mobile phone for, and that is accessing social media, of course. Is this something that you think about as a parent, or are you comfortable with it? You'll know, of course, that Australia recently brought in a ban on social media, most of the social media apps, for under 16s. So it's not forever. And we're not talking about mobile phones. We're talking about social media for under 16. So Instagram, TikTok, that kind of thing. And now we hear that the government is looking at all the options. They have said, haven't they, that this is not There are no current plans to introduce a blanket ban on smartphones or social media for children. But at the same time, they are looking at all the options. When it comes to children's safety, they said to LBC, nothing is off the table, but any action must be based on robust evidence. So I wonder, what can we read into that? And is that a conversation you think we should be having, or that the government should be having at that kind of level? Should they be now looking at the evidence the way that Australia did, and then making a decision in consultation with parents, with schools, with children, about what would be the benefits of banning social media for under 16s? Now, I know a lot of you will hear the word ban and you'll harumph. You'll think, hang on a second, why are we always banning things? But we have banned things in the past that we thought were harmful to people. For example, smoking in public places. We have banned things. There have been huge outcries before it has happened. And then it's kind of become something we've lived with. So would you support a ban on social media for under 16s? Is this a fight? Is this an argument that you have in your household? Or perhaps your children use social media very responsibly. But I know many, many parents. I have a 10-year-old, so she doesn't have a phone. She's not on social media yet. Is this something that happens in your house where you are concerned at the length of time that a child, your child, is spending on social media? And I said at the top that it's different for adults. I know that sounds really hypocritical and we probably should lead by example. However, if you scroll for 2 hours on social media, I don't know what it's necessarily going to affect. Does it make you a bit of a boring person? Potentially. I include myself in that. But does it affect your learning at school? Does it affect how you interact with people? Does it affect learning social skills, which we all learned, didn't we, when we were teenagers? So, would you support a ban on social media for under 16s? I know your kids would probably be up in arms, wouldn't they? It's something that they have. It's something they connect with their friends. It's something they use to post stuff on. It's how they communicate now. And if that was taken away for children who currently use social media, they would be very annoyed. And I don't know, would you be annoyed, or actually would you be relieved? Because who wants to be that parent who is the only one who is saying to their child, the only one in the class who's saying to their child, you can't go on social media and everyone else is? If there was a blanket ban on social media for under 16s, there would be none of that, because all the kids would be in the same boat. I mean, I'm not minded to ban things. I don't like the sound of it. But I really do worry about the effect that social media can have, the bullying, the grooming, all sorts of bad stuff that goes on there. And I know it's in a minority of cases, but it feels like a hellhole sometimes. It really does for young kids. It feels like a hellhole for us adults sometimes. So how do children navigate that? Anyway, let me know what you think. Would you support a ban on social media for under 16s? 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp on the same number. You can text 84850, or you can ask Alexa to send a comment to LBC. Right, let's speak to Professor Sonia Livingston, who is Director of the Digital Futures for Children.